This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John McNown, Jr. Today is January 28th, 2004. It's approximately 8:36 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm again in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. McNown is in Mission, Kansas. Sir, let's pick up where we left off. We had discussed some in-the-field experience and some of the combat and various things like that. Let me ask you a couple of general questions about life in the field. Tell me about how you all kept up with news and what was happening back in the rear and then also really overseas back home in the United States.
Okay, we had several sources for news when we were in the field. One was people carry transistor radios, and often you could pick up Armed Forces Vietnam radio. So there, you know, there'd be some kind of news, and it was usually it wasn't direct from NBC or something. So I think they filtered it quite a bit for us. But you'd get news that way, and a lot of whatever radio songs were popular at the time, you'd pick up that. It was kind of funny. They would actually, as they showed in the film Good Morning Vietnam, actually censor some of that. I remember there was a song, and I think it was by the Animals, called Sky Pilot in maybe early 69, late 68, and they played it once or twice, and then somebody figured out that it was, you know, about chaplains, and it wasn't very nice, and they quit playing it. They banned it from Armed Forces Radio, and of course, everybody immediately wanted to try to get a copy sent from home if they were back in a rear area someplace so they could have it, but you would get it from the radio. I know they had television at some of the larger areas. I was up at Da Nang when I went on R&R and actually saw that they had some kind of Armed Forces television up there, but we didn't have that in any of the areas where I was during the year. Then we'd get occasionally a copy of the Stars and Stripes out in the field, which was the Armed Forces newspaper,
right?
And we'd pick up news from there, and then people subscribe to local newspapers from home. For instance, I had a subscription to the Springfield, Missouri paper, which is where I'd gone to college, and I used it mostly to keep up with my old college sports team, but you'd pick up news that way, and we'd pass those things around when we got them in the mail, which wasn't too often, because often, they'd make sure you got all the letters first, and depending on if there was room, they'd give you your magazine subscriptions and things like that. And for instance, people that subscribe to some of the magazines like Playboy, they would often arrive without the centerfolds and stuff out in the field. The people in the rear would open the people's mail and take out the part they wanted sometimes, which wasn't too exciting. Letters from home, people would say things in letters from home, and all that information would get passed around. And so that's mostly how we kept up with what was going on in the States. And then occasionally, when you got new people in, they'd have some information. People would ask them about things, especially, when things started going badly as far as the public opinion about the war. When people come in from the States, they'd say, well, what's going on over there about this or that? And people were concerned about that just because, it didn't make you feel very good. You had people back in the United States that were upset about what we were doing. And of course, we were doing what we thought the country was asking us to do. So, it was funny because those things would all get mixed up sometimes, and you get rumors started. There was a rumor I know one time that Gene Dixon, and this had come out of probably National Enquirer or something, that had predicted that everybody in the 11th Infantry Brigade with a serial number ending in 6 would be killed between two dates. And that just swept all over. I think that was around the whole brigade in about 3 hours. And then that persisted for a long time, and I don't know where that came from. Huh. And then we had one that was just a real treat. We were out south of LZ Cork, which was quite a ways out in the mountains, or at least for us, for being out in the mountains. And It was in November and the monsoons and things were just, you know, just pretty miserable. And this rumor got started that Captain Rob, who was the company commander of Bravo Company, had a baby boy.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't seen anybody from Bravo Company. We hadn't seen anybody from Charlie. We hadn't seen anybody in probably 2 weeks. We'd just been out there in the mountains, you know, humping around looking for NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe it. So we got someplace where we could get a hold of Bravo Company on the radio, and I called and congratulated him. And he said, "Well, I didn't have a baby." And I said, "You didn't?" And he said, "No." And so I started going back down the line to find out where this came from.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that, if you remember, I think it was Linda Baines Johnson married a Captain Rob that was a Marine Corps that later became a senator, I believe, or in Virginia. And they'd had a baby, and somehow that had, you know, passed from being Captain Rob, the son-in-law of the president, to Captain Rob and B Company.
Right, right.
But so things like that would happen all the time. You'd get these rumors, you know, somebody passed along. It's just like the old thing you played in school with gossip, and,
mm-hmm.
and by the time it got to somebody, it completely changed, and then that story would become real. So.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the anti-war movement. What were your feelings about it? You mentioned it briefly there, and how did it affect morale for you all out back in Vietnam?
Actually, it in 68, you know, it really hadn't got the full head of steam going yet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that, you know, it really started. I think the main thing that was hurting morale at that time, it was just starting up, but it had become apparent that we hadn't figured out how to you know, win the war. That we just kept, you know, sending people over and didn't have a plan. I think that was pretty apparent from watching the news, and certainly after Tet of 68, the news had become much more negative about our involvement and the fact that we didn't have a plan and that the people over there may not have wanted us to be there.
Right.
And then in November of 68, they stopped the bombing of the North. And that affected morale a lot because at that point, it became, you know, it was just real obvious. And, of course, that was played up in the Stars and Stripes and on everything there in Vietnam. That was big news. But it became apparent that we had pretty much given up the idea that we were going to win the war and just wanted out.
Mm-hmm.
Even to the average grunt, and at that point, I think the morale of the Army really started going down just because nobody wanted to be the last man killed in Vietnam.
Right.
And I think that affected morale at that time more than the anti-war movement. I think that probably came later in 69 and 70 after I left, after the anti-war movement picked mm-hmm. up a lot more steam and a lot more publicity.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't like the fact that that we were over there. I think, you know, there are a lot of people to this day that served in Vietnam that are very much opposed to any kind of anti-war movement on the basis that that it you know, it gives aid and comfort to the enemy, and no matter what the national policy is, that because of the way the news goes around the world and that affects things, that it's undermining the morale and the ability of the armed forces to do whatever they've been sent to do.
Right.
And so from that standpoint, I do think that people really resented the fact that you had people, especially the ones who were waving North Vietnamese or Viet Cong flags, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think they resented that more than the fact that they wanted us to come home. And so I think it was the people that were on the extreme end of the anti-war movement. I think everybody resented that, and there was a lot of anger over that.
Right. Did you notice, as events unfolded back in the United States, and then of course you said this was, I mean, you were there 68, 69, and this moves into your time in the rear area back at brigade headquarters, did you notice anger, or what was the dominant emotion when it came to what was happening back in Washington and the rest of the country?
I would say that you know, resentment and anger, I don't know if anger during my time would be the real but there was a lot of resentment. I'd say it hadn't gotten to the point that you might say it was real anger. There was some anger, I think, among people, but a lot of that depended on the unit and how much they let people dwell on it, I think. That mm-hmm. is like a lot of things. They're like that. If you let people dwell on it and festers, it turns from resentment into anger. But I do think there was a lot of resentment that we were over there doing what we were trying to do and what we were being told to do, and that people back in the States were getting, and I really think the anti-war movement got out of control as far as the blame they placed on the individual troops rather than
right.
focusing on the government.
Right.
And there was a lot of anger about that part of it, I think, about the, you know, and I never experienced much of any of that when I came home or while I was in the service. And you hear stories and you wonder how much of them are like urban legends where it happened once or twice and it got spread out, you know, about mm-hmm. people spitting on people and people, you know, shooting people that got off of airplanes because their son didn't get home. I mean, all those stories got spread, and the more they got spread, I think the more anger there was among the troops that, you know, that it just wasn't fair. Mm-hmm. I think that's what, if you look at the source of the anger, it was that it wasn't fair.
Right.
That I'm over here doing what I've been asked to do, and these people are acting like I'm, you know, some sort of a monster. And I don't know how much of that, I've heard some stories from a few of the fellows that are in our unit, but not a lot. And
mm-hmm.
so I think it really had to do where you are. If you were in the Midwest, you probably didn't experience much of it. If you were, you know, from the San Francisco area or the Washington, D.C. area, I understand things got pretty bad in Washington, D.C. I've talked to people whose sons or husbands were killed and were buried in the D.C. area, and I guess they actually had protested their burials.
Hmm.
And that's supposedly firsthand information, but I never saw any of that here in the Midwest. So.
Right. Going back into the field, what would you all do for entertainment and keeping yourself on the lighter side?
Well, there was lots of various ways to do it. In a way, there wasn't a lot of entertainment. We didn't, we didn't have, they finally started having stand downs in January 69 after I was out of the field. Our unit hadn't had a stand down, I don't think, since like April or March of 68.
Mm-hmm.
We were either on a fire base or in the field
mm-hmm.
constantly for nine months. We'd get our beer and soda ration. That was always something to look forward to.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, if we were in an area where it wasn't much going on and a couple of people could get together, they might play some cards or something. We thought we were in a relatively safe area and they were back someplace where there was some cover. You might see some of that, especially like in a bunker on a fire base during the daytime when things were relatively calm. We had one fellow that when you go into the villages, these kids would come out and try to sell you things. And
mm-hmm.
one of the things they sold was they had little things about pictures that were about the size of playing cards, and they were on stiffer material, and they were all pornographic.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple of fellows that amused themselves by buying these pictures, and then they'd try to trade them with the kids or with each other to get, like, collections of certain kinds of things, because that was the only thing you could buy when you were out in the field.
Right.
And it really had nothing to do with the porn. It had to do with it gave you something to do, you know. We had people that were actually fairly decent artists that would, you know, would draw on things, or actually I saw a guy carve a little thing in a tree stump one time. You know, we were at a place for a couple of days, and it was softwood, and he carved something in it. So, and you could listen to the radio. You know, you have an earphone on when we'd start, after we dug in or something, somebody could be listening on the radio to.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the big event, the the Tigers and the Cardinals played in the World Series that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a Cardinal fan, and we had several fellows in my platoon from the Detroit area. And we would, two or three in the morning, whatever the time that it was coming on live on AFVN, we would kind of crawl back into the center of the perimeter and listen real quietly to the, we'd be sitting there listening to the ball game. That's about the only time I remember doing something like that. So,
mm-hmm.
And a couple of people had early models of cassette tapes, I think. They just come out, as I remember, and somebody had sent their somebody a cassette tape, and they actually carried it in their pack as additional weight, and everybody made fun of them. But
mm-hmm.
They could then record and send stuff back to their folks. But for the most part, there wasn't a whole lot of things to sit there and entertain, other than you'd have some gallows humor occasionally and some things. But it wasn't a whole lot of entertainment going on.
Right. What role did music play in your time in the field and in your life in Vietnam in general?
I always think of it as a rock and roll war. because it was every place you went, there was music. I remember going in on a combat assault in a Huey, and I was wearing a helmet talking to the pilot because I was the acting company commander at the time, and he had his radio on the nav channel, which
mm-hmm.
was where you could pick up the AM stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we were going in, and the gunships were going by us, firing into the LZ. And Stephen Wolf was on playing Magic Carpet Ride.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, to this day, when I hear that song, I can picture those gunships going down there and us coming in on those choppers. And a lot of stuff like that. I mean,
right.
Music. I think anyone when you're someplace special and you hear a song, it brings that back. And
mm-hmm.
and so there's a lot of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Lou Rawls. I think a lot of people remember the same song. So they were. I think Detroit City was really popular
mm-hmm.
for a while when I was over there. And Janis Joplin, Peace of My Heart. There was a time when if you were in a rare area. Just about any place you went, you could hear Janis Joplin singing Peace of My Heart. On the people in the rear would have gotten stereos coming in from Japan,
mm-hmm.
and it'd just be kind of blasting out, in the evening there. So a lot of music.
What about, go ahead.
No, no.
Okay. What about drug and alcohol use in the field and in the rear?
In the... In our outfit in 68, there was I only know one fellow that was using any marijuana in the field,
mm-hmm.
and he was pretty harmless, and his job was to carry the red mail bags for the company command post if we couldn't get him back on the choppers. He had a rifle that wouldn't even fire, as a matter of fact. And he was just, it was just a weird, he was sort of almost like a company pet. I mean, he
uh-huh.
was, Wally was, everybody liked Wally, but they knew he just didn't have any business out there, and he just thought that as long as he was with us, he was perfectly safe, and he didn't need bullets. It was okay.
The gun that didn't fire, that was it
yeah,
rigged?
It had been hit by a mortar on, May, I guess, up
mm-hmm.
north, and it actually had a little bend in the barrel and a crease where this piece of shrapnel had hit it, and he just never got any more bullets, and the company commander thought that was fine, because he was worried that Wally, you just couldn't keep Wally away from the pot. He'd find someplace. If you were going to villages and stuff, I mean, you could buy it if you wanted to. When we're back on a fire base, if it was, depending on where the fire base was, if it was in the, down along Highway 1 and, close to some villages, certainly there was alcohol use, and I know that, there was, in the bunkers in the evening, sometimes people would get a little mellow up there
mm-hmm.
in the fire bases. So there was that. Not a lot, I don't remember any heavy drug use. When I was with the company in the field, when I got back in the rear, it was a whole different story. A lot more drug use going on in the rear, and matter of fact, we caught a guy smoking grass out in the field one time, and he got the hell beat out of him because, I mean, you just didn't do it. You just weren't alert, and it was just not something we put up with.
Mm-hmm.
What
were the drugs of choice back in the rear?
I think, you know, I can't tell you for sure because a lot of the people that, but I do know that they had, you could get LSD, you could get, you'd get marijuana that was laced with opium, which was supposedly a much better deal. And then you'd have some pill poppers, I think, you know, and I don't know exactly what they were taking, but,
right.
And occasionally somebody would pick up opium, from someplace, but see, I heard a lot about people smoking, marijuana that was laced with opium, mm-hmm. you know, to give a bigger high. And they actually used to sell prepackaged marijuana cigarettes that were in cool packages, and I mm-hmm. think they spelled the word cool differently on them, but you could actually have them so it appeared like you were smoking a real cigarette rather than, huh. you know, rolling your own.
Mm-hmm.
There was, like I said, and I think the reason in the rear area that you saw so much more is people were bored, that, you know, they'd be on duty 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, or whatever, and then all of a sudden they'd be off someplace where they were either, you know, back in a tent kit barracks kind of a deal, or setting up out in a bunker on the perimeter someplace with nothing to do, and I just think a lot of it had to do with boredom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I understand from people who are back over there in 70 and 71, the drug use was a lot more pervasive mm-hmm. then, and I was on the DMZ in Korea in 71, and the drug use was just really bad there. So I think that, you know, by that time the morale had gotten, you know, down so low in areas, and the discipline
mm-hmm.
just wasn't there, and so there was a lot of drug use then.
Okay. Tell me about your contact with home and your family and how that transpired.
Most of it was letters, of course. I got to talk. I was engaged when I went over, and I got to talk to my fiance once,
mm-hmm.
And I talked to my parents once on Mars. You'd have to go up and use the Mars radio.
Right.
And there'd be these huge, you know, list of people to get up there. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. So it was real spotty.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of it was by letter. And, of course, you could write, you know, even when we were out in the field, you could tear the top off of a C-ration carton and write a note on the back and address it and put free on it. And they'd, you know, it'd get home.
Right.
So that's how most of the correspondence took place at that time.
How often did you write?
I was really good when I first got there. When I was got in the field, I'd taken a actually I hadn't taken. My dad had given me this huge fistful of postcards
mm-hmm.
and told me that I needed to drop a note to my mom every day. And I was pretty good before things got real busy. And once they got real busy, it got harder. And so then I was a little more sporadic, but I tried to write home at least once a week, especially when I was out in the field. I tried to get some kind of a note off every few days, just a little on, I'm all right, walking through the rice paddies, you know, see you 9 months or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I got in the rear, I'd write more, you know, elaborate letters, and I was probably... I probably wrote either my fiance or my parents probably 3 times a week, and then I think I got more lax about it as I got shorter. And I know one time I went almost a month without writing anybody, and I got this. My mother had written a Red Cross or somebody; she got worried about me.
Okay. What about the role of religion in the field? Can you talk about your personal experience what you witnessed?
Yeah, I remember seeing a chaplain while I was in the field twice. once right before we went off the Hawthorne to this real heavy combat, and we didn't like that. It did not seem like a good omen that they brought the chaplain in to talk to the troops, because right. we'd already been hearing things. And mm-hmm. and then I saw a Catholic chaplain actually out at Hawthorne doing Mass mm-hmm. About the fifth day. And other than that, I had a good friend who was a chaplain after I was in the rear, and I went to services a few times, and a rocket hit his office. He wasn't there when it hit, but the attendance dropped way off, because I don't know if people didn't think he had it in good with the Lord or what. it was... you know, I'd be hard put to myself. I don't see where God is on the battlefield. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. I'd gone to church pretty regularly when I was in college. I was sporadic, and once I got in the Army, I was probably less than sporadic. Just really occasional. And I think it's just the time of your life. You know, when you're younger, you have a tendency to, and. But I know that you talk to some people and they say there aren't any atheists in the foxholes, and I talk to people who've been in foxholes that believe that. I think there's a lot of atheists in the foxholes myself. I think they would like God to save them, but they don't have any confidence that that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't think that. In combat, there's a whole lot of place for religion. It's interesting, at our reunion in Reno this year, we're going to have the first of the 20th chaplain is joining mm-hmm. us, a guy named Max Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually did the invocation, the dedication prayer at the wall. And he received the Silver Star for treating wounded in Alpha Company under fire in June of 69.
Mm-hmm.
He actually would get out and walk with the with the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard about chaplains like that. I didn't personally experience that, but I know all these guys think a lot of Chaplain Sullivan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being a chaplain in a combat situation would be a tough deal, because it's really hard to figure out where God is
mm-hmm.
out on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to reconcile that after I got home. So,
have you been able to do so?
Yeah, I think so. I had a bishop tell me one time that, because I had two things. I believe that in some ways combat's the most Christian experience. If you're a Christian, if you're a Muslim, it could be a Muslim experience, I suppose, that you can have, because it's the only place that you can see on a daily basis that people are willing to sacrifice themselves for their friends. And I think there's something truly noble and probably religious about that. And I think that's the reason that people who are in combat units together, you know, even though they may be sociologically and all kinds of difference, they really are close to each
mm-hmm.
other
mm-hmm.
Because you don't have too many people you know that are willing to do that, and you know they're willing to do that.
Right.
And I think that if you look back at the experience, you can take it and learn something about yourself and humanity, and maybe by learning something about that, learn something about what God would have us to be rather than what we are. And I do think that there is, in retrospect, things that you can learn about religion from having been in combat.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time there's not much you can learn about it. I think it has to be something you look back and when you meditate and review things, you can bring religious lessons from it, but it's not a religious experience in itself. I think you have to learn a lot about forgiving yourself and forgiving others if you've been in combat, which is a religious thing. So, and it's a hard thing to do sometimes. So,
have you been able to forgive yourself for anything that you might have done? Or
yeah, I had a bishop. I'm an Episcopalian. I had a bishop who was a very bright, very profound man, and he's also an ambitious man. It just proves that everything, you know, works the same way. He became Bishop of New York eventually from being Bishop of Kansas. But I was telling him that we had a situation at Hawthorne where we went through this, and I think I may have mentioned it, where we went through the across this trench, and I told everybody I didn't want anybody moving behind us, and there was a lot of wounded NVA that were wounded just, like, you know, horribly, but we didn't have anybody to pull back from, and I didn't mention that. And for a long time, that bothered me, just having given the order. I to this day, I would give the same order in the same circumstance. I just really bothered me for a long time. And I was talking to Bishop Grine one day, and he said, I just have this thing I just can't forgive myself for. And he said, you know, that's arrogance. He said that's nothing but arrogance. He said that it's not up to you to forgive yourself for things. God takes care of that for you. And I thought about it, and it was that if you think there's something that's so unforgivable that God can't forgive you, then that's just arrogance on your part. And I think he's right about that. So it was a really helpful thing to have somebody tell me.
Right. John, let me ask you a couple other questions about in the field, and I'm curious as to the terrain of Vietnam. What were your impressions of where you were?
I think it's beautiful. I think Vietnam is as beautiful a place as I have ever seen where we were. We were at a place called Duc Pho, which is on the coastal plain. But the mountains sweep down from the north along the coastal plain there, and at the bottom of Quang Ngai province actually touched the ocean. So depending on where you were, the mountains were either closer or further away. And so you had these rice paddies and these rivers coming out of the mountains with tree lines along them, and the little villages and the beautiful beaches. I mean, just absolutely gorgeous beaches. I mean, in Florida or Hawaii even would kill for the beaches in Quang Ngai province, I think. Then when you got up in the mountains, there were these clear rivers and these waterfalls, and there's the trees. Of course, they were full of bugs and things, which wasn't good. But as far as just being a beautiful, green, lush place, palm trees, pineapple plants, just a beautiful place. And of course, when you're looking at it from our standpoint, it was also a dangerous place, because the rice paddies, you'd be out in the open for a long time, and they were always surrounded by hedgerows. And there was a lot of hedgerows in the area where we were in Vietnam that lined the trails and the streams and cut off one hamlet's rice paddy area from another one. So anytime you were crossing paddies, there was always these thick hedgerows that you were walking into. And so one of the things that made it kind of quaint and pretty, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, beautiful, also made it very dangerous. And of course, once you got up into the mountains and you got back up into the canopy, things were just very thick and you couldn't see. Crossing streams was always dangerous, so you'd have to find a place to ford. And so it was, but it's just this, as far as the terrain went itself, it was just absolutely, I think, a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm. What about your experience with the animal wildlife of Vietnam?
We got around to, it's not wildlife, the most dangerous animal we probably ran into was water buffalo, because they didn't like the way we smelled,
right.
And they were huge, and if one would lose control and start charging, it was a really scary thing.
Mm-hmm.
for, you know, I remember seeing very little wildlife. We saw, and partially, you know, I was out with a rifle company, and we were kind of noisy, I suspect. You know, you got 100 guys all burdened down and slipping and sliding, you know, whatever. And so it, unless you're on point, I don't think you saw much wildlife. I remember seeing a couple of small deer, snakes. I remember specifically seeing bamboo vipers because we kept finding in one of these night defensive positions we'd set up, and people wanted to move, and it was.
What do you mean they were in the holes itself?
No, they were in, we were dug in around a clump of a big clump of bamboo up in the mountains, and they were in the trees.
Right.
And they all of a sudden people started finding them, or they dropped down, and it was not the. But we didn't really have an opportunity to move, so we just hope we killed them all. And we didn't, you know, we didn't, nobody got bit or anything, as it turned out. The leeches were worse than the vipers. Remember, a lot of, you know, insects, mosquitoes, leeches, land leeches, water leeches, and birds, you'd see birds, of course, out, you know, see birds along the ocean, and when you got in the mountains, there was different types of birds. But I don't ever remember seeing monkeys. I think I heard some a couple of times. I don't remember that particularly. I know people have seen elephants and tigers, but I never saw any really major wildlife. I remember even when we were back in the mountains, it was during the monsoon, so they may not have been moving that much, you know. So.
Right. Were you ever exposed to any of the defoliants that you're aware of?
Well, yeah. And you know what I think? My personal opinion is everybody got exposed to defoliants. And we were never in a defoliated area. Okay, and I need to differentiate between that. So when you're talking about moving through a defoliated area, like you had up along the DMZ and other places, we were never operating in an area like that. But they used to use Agent Orange around the fire bases and the brigade base camp to keep the foliage down there for the fields of fire.
Okay.
And I don't think that's something they've ever talked about much, but I've noticed now that they've changed the rules on that, and anybody that served in Vietnam is eligible, and I think that's the reason, because it finally came out. We had to... fellow was in my platoon, and he died of a very rare cancer that, you know, the VA finally said after, you know, 2 days after he died, gave him his, certification that was an Agent Orange-related cancer, but it was a very severe form of, and rare form of bone cancer. And I'm pretty sure he got it after he became company clerk, because he spent a lot of time out on the, you know, in the evenings, he would be on bunker duty on the brigade base camp. And my suspicion is, and we all wrote a letter into the VA about how they'd use, you know, they'd combine the helicopters and spray around the brigade base camp. And so I'm pretty sure that anybody that was there, and maybe people in the rear got exposed more than people in that were in the field, depending on where you were.
Right.
So, but we never had the problem with drinking water and that kind of thing, I think, that you hear about, you know, with some of the units.
Right. What about R&Rs? Did you get to take one?
Yeah, I went to Sydney, Australia in April of 69 and had a wonderful time. I'd like to go back someday. I was down there during their Anzac celebration. I was in Sydney, and every... veteran of World War II and Korea and whatever in Australia seemed like was in Sydney, and I don't think I bought a drink the entire week because they knew that we were I was an American because my hair was a lot shorter than anybody else's there, and they just when they found out what we were in the AmeriCal division, because the AmeriCal had served in the South Pacific in World War II, and they all knew that down there. It was amazing. They knew more about it than people in the United States did. I'd never heard of it, but the people in Australia knew about the AmeriCal division, and just very gracious, nice people had a wonderful time. And
did you go by yourself?
Yeah, went to, well, you know, there was a couple of fellows I knew that turned out that we were down there at the same time. We kind of hung out for the first couple of days, and then I did a couple of, I took a ferry about 40 miles up the coast one day on a kind of a Sunday cruise, and there was, I think there was only two other Americans on it, and there was probably 500 or 600 people. And it was just an absolutely wonderful day. I mean, people just, you know, met some families and did some things, went to the zoo one day, because I used to, I still am kind of a zoo freak. I love to go see exotic animals, and I knew at that time there was animals that they didn't let out of Australia. That the only place you could see them was there. So I went over to see a platypus and didn't get to see it. It didn't come out. Yeah, so that was a disappointment, but I saw a lot of other other animals, and, you know, met families there, and people were just very, very nice to us, and I just have very fond memories of all the people in Australia.
How did you feel?
Quite a clean city and
really
neat place at the time. So
how did you feel when you got back? Were you rested? Were you ready?
No, I was worn out. I mean, it was a long flight down there. You know, I partied I'm telling you about the kind of nice things. I also went out, you know, every night and stayed up half the night and drank a lot more than I should have, and just had a heck of a time. Stayed. I think that's when I found out. I thought I was pretty clean from him because I'd been out of the field by that time. I'd come out of the field late November, and this was probably like the 10th of April, 15th of April, right around there. So I'd been out of the field a long time. You know, I'd been taking showers, and I thought I was pretty clean, and I took a bath. I mean, it was just what a wonderful thing. Turned all this hot water on, took a bath, and my pores opened up, and all my tan came out. You know, it was so. It was just a wonderful time. It was in the April is the fall down there, so it was kind of cool. And I remember they still own a sweater that I bought while I was down there. It bought me a really good wool sweater, and I still have it. So weather was crisp and nice. I mean, it was probably in the 70s. Felt kind of cold actually to me, but. It was just a great time.
Did your unit ever engage in any civic action while you were out in the field or in the rear?
No.
Okay. Was that encouraged or discussed or just not part
of
it?
No, I don't think it was part of the mission there. I know we had an S5 area, you know, at Brigade, and I think they even had an S5. I think Lieutenant Kelly was an S5 officer at one time, which was a civic action person, which that seems kind of ironic.
That's a little ironic, yes.
But really, in Quang Nai Province, I don't think there was a lot of that going on. I mean, it was when you were in the field, it was, and that we didn't have any of the CAP units and things like that. Because I really, truly believe they're probably, even though they had a bunch of designated friendly villages along the highway there, Highway 1, we had what they call the Rural Development Area, the RD area, which ran either side of the highway, and that was supposedly under, you know, government control, the villages there. And I don't ever remember a village not getting at least sniped at one time while we were, you know, out in the field. I mean, it was just... they didn't like us. So no.
Okay.
The answer to that's no, and it never even occurred to me. I do think, you know, we did things. I think individuals going through, we helped treat some Vietnamese, you know, with the medics, if we were around the village, we're going to be around there for a day or so. I mean, it was just something you did, you know. I think we acted as well as we could given the circumstances, but we never had any orders or any program that I was aware of, at least in the rifle companies there to do that.
Can you talk to me about Vietnamese civilians? What was your impression of the indigenous population?
They were small, and they didn't speak English. They didn't know why. That's being funny. I felt kind of, we were mostly farmers where we were. We were in an area that was, was primarily rural. We never operated in any big villages, so we're going through hamlets all the time. So all you saw was farmers. And I felt sorry for them. I mean, we were going through in the daytime, and the NVA were coming through at night, and I thought, what a terrible way to have to. I mean, it was hard. It's a hard life being a farmer in rice paddies in a place where there's no mechanization to begin with, and most of them were poor. A lot of the women chewed betel nut and had red mouths and lips because they weren't getting any dental care.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked old before their time. You'd see young women that were beautiful young girls out there. They'd be 18, 17, and then you'd see women that were probably 26 or 27, and they already looked old.
Mm-hmm.
And you just thought it was a hard life, And mm-hmm. and of course, you very seldom saw a young man, anybody above 15 got drafted by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So if you saw one, you picked him up as a suspect. And then, of course, you saw old men and women and a lot of children. And their clothes were, I thought actually fairly clean if they were in the villes and considering the circumstances, they were washing them in streams and things, and it seemed to me like they were fairly industrious people as far as the farmers went, and you'd go into their little, their homes, their hooches, as we call them, and they had mud walls and thatched roofs, things were always pretty neat in there, and they had little rooms that they had dirt floors, but they would kind of keep them swept after a minute. And I just thought they were just industrious, probably would have been pretty good people under other circumstances. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course they resented us. You could tell that. And if we had armed people coming through our homes, we'd resent them, I'm sure. I guess if I had an overall feeling, I didn't trust any of them because, there wasn't any question. We hit booby traps outside every village. We get sniped at. I mean, there wasn't any question that these people did not want us there. But at the same time, I just felt, overall, it was just kind of a sad feeling for them. I just thought that, not so sad that we didn't do what we needed to do, but
mm-hmm.
that was just not a life I would want. I remember reading a poem years ago by a Vietnam veteran. I can't remember the guy's name, but he had a great. It was about a platoon of tracks going through a rice paddy, and one of the farmers started hitting one with a hoe. And it made them mad, so instead of going through in single file, where they just broke the dike in one place, they
mm-hmm.
turned and went online and broke his whole dike down.
Mm.
And the last line was, if you have a home in hell and a farm in Vietnam, sell the farm and go home.
Mm.
And I thought that's pretty appropriate. That's
mm-hmm.
pretty much how life would have been there.
Mm-hmm. The notion that you couldn't tell the enemy from your friend, was that true in Vietnam?
Certainly where we were, I mean, they all looked alike, the Viet Cong, they all dressed like the normal people and not necessarily back pajamas,
mm-hmm.
Shorts, whatever. I mean, they were just somebody that was out there in the fields someplace. And sometimes they were farmers by day and soldiers at night, and sometimes they were just soldiers all the time. And certainly the population there hid those people. I mean, they truly were, a fish swimming in the sea, as Mao said. And
mm-hmm.
they had main force Viet Cong elements, they had regional force Viet Cong elements, they had NVA. I mean, we had everything you could see, and we'd run into all different kinds, and you could tell how hardcore they were by whether they tried to maneuver on you or not, you know.
So, right.
It was, I don't think there was ever a question when we went to a village that it was really a friendly village. They'd sell us stuff, and you know, the kids would be nice trying to make money or something, but it was never a question. You didn't see fear and resentment and stuff in people's eyes.
You mentioned this resentment. How could you tell? I mean, just by their look?
Just their body language, and just, I mean, they were just the way they stood and the way they, you know, the way they watched you, and you just like any place where you walk in, and you know, all of a sudden you think that you don't belong, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was that feeling. You walked in, and you know, we don't belong here. Those people don't want us here.
Mm-hmm.
And like I, you know, by the time I got there, I don't know. I mean, we'd come to these burned out huts, and there'd be, you know, the 4th Division had been through there, the 101st had been through there, the 1st Air Cav had been through there, you know, and so, you know, obviously there was no reason for people there to think that we were there for, you know, you just don't send that many divisions through one province.
And how did you coach your men on how to handle the civilians and how to treat them and talk with them, or what kind of contact to have with them, et cetera?
Well, when we, you know, if we had to search a village, we'd have to go and round everybody up and put them up, and we would put people that were reasonable people in charge of watching them. And then we'd come through there, and we, you know, for the most part, we did not let people, try to keep them from putting their hands on people if we could. You had most of the guys were pretty good guys. We had very few that wanted to, occasionally you'd have one you'd have to be careful of that would be just like a bully would be in the States, you know, you'd have to be careful of somebody, and all of a sudden the next thing you look up and he was slapping somebody or doing something, yelling at them, you know, VC ado, which means, I guess, where are the VC?
Right.
And of course, they're speaking in English, you know, yelling at me and something in Vietnam, or, you know, VC no bic or whatever, and Vietnamese, and the guy would be getting madder, you know, and you just have to pull him off and say, oh, you know, hey, get out there on perimeter guard or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficult thing, I think, is when you work with the PRUs, the Provisional Reconnaissance Units of the Vietnamese, South Vietnamese Army, or the National Police, I mean, they were brutal people, just absolutely unmerciful, and you see them treating these people that way, and so certainly there wasn't any good examples to be gained by working with the Arvins or the National Police, and it was not a good situation there in Quang Ngai. So as far as I know, we never had any incidents in the company. When we were out in the Pinkville there, and I mean, which is a bad place, we had some guys starting to light a bill up, and we got that stopped, and a couple of things like that. But we, you know, I mean, it's, we try to remind everybody we're there to be soldiers, you know, all the time, and we weren't a mob, and so, I mean, we didn't use those words, but that was the message all the time, and we had a good unit, and I think we acted that way, so.
Have you had any contact with Vietnamese since Vietnam?
You know, just a few here in Kansas City. And a lot of them are younger. I've seen very, you know, I think I've only met one person that ever served in the South Vietnamese Army. And to be honest, if I was going to have contact with the Vietnamese, and most of them claim they're from Saigon or Da Nang or something, so I have no idea what life was like for them.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest, if I was going to talk to somebody, I'd rather talk to an NVA or a Viet Cong. I didn't care for the South Vietnamese Army much.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I have no positive feelings about our allies.
I know we've already talked about that a little bit, but in general, why?
Just because I think that all my contact with the South Vietnamese Army, they either ran off or the regional forces or whatever. You know, when contact started, they obviously didn't want to make contact, the units in our area.
Mm-hmm.
The regular Arvins, the 1st Arvin Division was just north of us. The regional forces actually had, we had bridges overrun, everybody, pretty much massacred squads because the people that were supposed to be helping them guard ran off and, left the 10 guys or 6 guys there to face an NVA company or something.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have good feelings about those kind of people. And then my dealings with the national police, every time I saw them, they were beating or torturing people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't have any good feelings about them. And I think that even though I don't think the Vietnamese people were necessarily better off under, probably not better off under the communists,
mm-hmm.
just because, but certainly the regime we were in there supporting in our area was certainly not worth the effort.
Right. Okay. John, why don't we take a break for a moment?
Okay, sure.
Okay, John. Let's talk about your transition to the rear, to brigade.
Okay.
How did that happen, and what were your duties and your life like back in the rear?
Okay. I, I remember the date. It was November 20th of 1968. I had been actually the acting company commander running the company out in the field. Our Captain Bartlett, who'd been our company commander, had been wounded on mm-hmm. the 7th, and we had this Lieutenant Davis, who was the XO, and they brought him back in. So he came back in on about the 18th, and mm-hmm. on the 20th, all of a sudden they pulled me out to go to the rear because we had a new captain coming in, Captain David Walsh, to take over the company. And I was the battalion commander had decided to give me Bravo Company. So I was supposed to go back and then sign for all the equipment and everything at Bravo Company.
Right.
And so they picked me up out in the jungle, and I went to a place called LZ Cork, which was, if you ever talk to anybody from the 11th Infantry Brigade, it's been out there. It was a unique place. And out in the mountains. And got there, and there was no more helicopters. Once I got there, I couldn't get back to Duck Pho, and I met Captain Walsh, and we spent the night, had a couple of beers out there on this forward fire base, and talked about the company because
mm-hmm.
he wanted to know about that. So then I went back in I guess when I originally went back in, I was going to be pay officer and executive officer, and this other guy was leaving. That was it. So I went back in to do all that stuff, and the next thing I know, come out, pay the troops at the end of the month, and I had, I think I went back and I slept for about 2 days. I had a cot, and I literally slept, got up, ate, went back to sleep for the first 2 days I was in the rear.
Where was this again?
This was at, I was in Duck Pho.
Okay.
And at LZ Bronco, which was the 11th Infantry Brigade base camp. That's where our battalion rear area was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went up and I paid the troops, and I had to go up to Chulai, to the division headquarters, to pay the people that were wounded in the hospital up there.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up there, and that was just a real experience because I'd been out in the field now since August without coming in. And I got up there, and they had, the hospital had, a cafeteria, and there was these nurses in civilian clothes there, they were off duty, and they had MPs and stuff, and it was surreal. I just sat there and ate for a long time and just kind of looked around, and then I went in and paid the fellows that were in the hospital, and then went back to Duck Pho, and when I got back there, Colonel Gwynn told me I was going to take over Bravo Company.
Mm-hmm.
So I went over to, and I didn't understand why they didn't give Captain Walsh Bravo Company and let me keep my old company because I knew people and, stuff. And
mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I went over, started signing for all the equipment and stuff. You have all this paperwork you have to do if you take over as a company commander. So you have to sign for the equipment. And I was signing for the equipment, and I was bringing people in, and they had a number of soldiers who were refusing to go to the field in Bravo Company for whatever reasons. They had some morale problems in that particular company, mm-hmm. I think. And so some of those, you know, I was giving them a choice, either pick up their stuff or go to jail.
Right.
And so we set up some special court-martials for some of those, and I'd been there about 3 days getting that all straightened out before I was supposed to go out and to the field and take the company over. And suddenly we got another rash of captains and new lieutenants in. And so they had this captain show up. Of course, they had to give him the company because I was a first lieutenant. And so they sent me back to Alpha Company, and the colonel came in and said, look, John, he said, I have a we've got a request from Brigade to nominate somebody to go forward and interview for a job at Brigade Headquarters, and I'm going to nominate you.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but you have a choice. He said, I think this is a good job, and I would, you know, he said, you don't want to send somebody up there. He was very nice about the way he did it, and he said, or you can stay back and be an executive officer, and I can find, you know, take somebody as a second choice, but you're the senior lieutenant in the field. And he said, you know, I was going to put you in charge of a company. I'd like to, for you to go up and interview. So I said, sure, I'll go up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out that the job paid flight pay, which was a real incentive.
Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed with the S2 up there, who was a major, and you know, I don't even remember his name now. He wasn't there a whole long time after I got back up there. I interviewed with him and the brigade executive officer, and I don't think I ever talked to the brigade commander. And then they had six people interviewing for the job, and I got it.
Okay. Let me ask you, what kind of things were they asking you? What were they interested in for this position?
It was mainly what my experience was. They took a look at, you know, what my records, you know, asked what I'd done at Fort Benning, what I'd done, you know, after I got out of Benning, before I came to Vietnam. They talked to my battalion commander about, you know, what I'd done in the field, mm-hmm. and then just basically talked to me about, you know, running patrols and doing paperwork. And I don't remember a whole lot of specific questions that we went through. I just remember talking to these people. And when I got all done, they called and said, okay, the next day, and said, you've got the job. You know, you need to get up here.
This is in July.
This is the 11th Brigade Headquarters at LZ Bronco.
Oh, still at Bronco.
So, yeah,
okay.
So they would have been going up to Brigade Headquarters instead of staying with the battalion.
Okay.
And so they were around. There was a big mountain in the middle of the brigade base camp called Montezuma.
Mm-hmm.
And it was on the west side of Montezuma, and the 1st to the 20th was on the south side, so I kind of moved a quarter of a way around the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get up there, and they wanted me to turn my rifle in and get one from them. So I made a deal with the S4s to keep my own rifle because, you know, I mean, it was kind of like a security blanket.
Right.
So we traded rifles out, and I moved in and went to work in this tent kit. It was had a big tent kit, and that was the brigade intelligence shop. And there was me and another assistant. I was the assistant brigade intelligence officer for air, the S2 air, and we had another assistant brigade intelligence officer that was a captain. He was a lawyer named Jerry Simmons. We had a master sergeant that was a brigade intelligence sergeant, and
mm-hmm.
two or three clerks, and then we had a major who was the actual S2 for the brigade, and
mm-hmm.
he spent most of his time flying around with the colonel, with the brigade commander and the command and control chopper, and then the rest of us sorted through information and did various things trying to figure out, you know, what the NVA and the Viet Cong were up to as well as we could with the information that we had.
Right. And, can you describe how you got that information and what kind of things you had to sift through?
Yeah, we got I'll tell you, my job, I was called the S2 air, and my job was to, do all the requests for air support that was not you know, immediate air support for, you know, for a unit in contact. Mm-hmm. So if we had some area that we felt warranted, you know, some kind of a bombing, you know, a B-52 or just a fighter bomber strike, you know, someplace, that I would do the request for that and send it up through through channels. I would do the visual reconnaissance. I flew visual reconnaissance most days, either in the little O-1, the, you know, the two-seater little planes. Sometimes flew out with the Air Force FACS in the second seat. Flew in light observation helicopters a lot, just going out, you know, checking out things in the mountains and, you know, just looking for things. I did all the coordination for the long-range reconnaissance patrols that ran out of the brigade. We would get information from the South Vietnamese police, the South Vietnamese Army. We'd get stuff from the division headquarters intelligence staff. We would get, you know, we would run side-looking airborne radar, you know, missions and get information from that, photo reconnaissance missions, sniffers, which was a two deal with a helicopter where they had a big scoop and they'd be going out testing the air and they'd get these little readings that were supposedly ammonia and given off by people sweating in the mountains, and then you'd mark them on the map and that would give you intelligence. Toward the end, we were starting to get in I forgot what they call them, but they were sensors. You could put sensors out, and they'd pick up metal, or they'd pick up movement, or they'd hear things. We were planning those. And so you just take all this various information and then try to make a picture out of it.
What was the most effective one of those, or a couple that were really good?
Yeah, the side-looking airborne radar was pretty worthless, but the Air Force loved it. And so we would run those missions and use them. Most of the time they'd pick up running water. They couldn't tell the difference between running water and a truck. And so if we wanted a mission out in the mountain someplace and we knew there was a lot of running water, but you couldn't see it, half the streams weren't even on the maps because the jungles covered them. But they'd pick them up with the radar. We'd run a SLAR mission out there and use it as part of our justification, even though we knew it didn't mean anything. But the Air Force never understood that. Sniffers were sometimes good, sometimes bad. You could fake those if you wanted to by firing artillery a couple of days beforehand. You weren't supposed to, but that would leave enough residue that would pick it up like there was people there.
Okay. So you guys would create the...
Yeah, so sometimes we would, if we had information, for instance, and the best information was actual sightings either by LRPs or American units. That was, you know, if somebody actually saw something, that was the best. The next best, you'd have to start sifting through was sometimes the information provided by the special forces camps. I went out every week or every 2 weeks to all the special forces camps that we, flew out there and talked to the people out there, and sometimes their information would be pretty good, you know, as far as the movements coming through the mountains heading toward the coastal plains. And then, you know, actual contact with the enemy was always a great one. And occasionally you get some helicopter pilot or somebody, you know, anything that was reported by an American was good. And then after that, you had certain, we had an intelligence unit that, an MI unit there that was attached to the brigade, and they were kind of weird. They, you know, none of them had any rank on. You never knew what they were, and they ran around in Jeeps and did stuff. And sometimes they had agents that I think they actually paid and stuff, you know, out in the field. And we get information from those, and that sometimes, you know, after a while, you got to sort you sort through. But the main thing I think that was as far as I was concerned, it was good, was actual some of it was taking this information. If you'd start remembering and plotting it, all of a sudden, if you'd start seeing a real pattern develop, you know, from different sources, you could figure something out, and that's mostly how we worked at the S2 officer really didn't do much. Most of the work was done by Captain Simmons, who was actually a lawyer that had he practiced for a while, and he'd been in ROTC, and they called him up, and he and I sifted through a lot of the stuff. He would start looking for things and then kind of pass them on to me because I'd been out on the ground. We had a really good intelligence sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would just look for patterns on things.
Such as troop movements or
rumors that, you know, something's going on, and that rumor would tie in with something from 2 or 3 days before. We got a lot of these little reports every day from the South Vietnamese, you know, they were just almost like hearsay kind of things. And then sometimes we'd actually get Viet Cong propaganda that would actually tell you something if you sifted through all the information in them.
You had somebody who could translate for you.
We had a translator, and a lot of times the Viet Cong were printing things in English and leaving them back, you know. And it always would read, you know, it was always some of that really, really bad communist overblown English, you know, with all the descriptive, you know, stuff in about how terrible we were and how, or, you know, trying to get people to give up and how we were, you know, terrible to the people. And we were really good, and we should, you know, leave our leaders and join their cause.
What kind of things would you look at or look for when you did the aerial reconnaissance?
You looked for movement. You looked, if you flew an area often enough, you looked to see if there was something that looked like it was different from before. You try different angles at different times of day to see if you were out in the mountains, you might be able to see some thatch from a hut that was back in the mountains someplace. Just catch something, where they were all of a sudden you popped up over a mountain and there was somebody moving down and they hadn't had time to hear you and get out of the way. Come in low and see if you could catch some fire someplace, you know. That was always a good one. I didn't like that one. As I got shorter, that one wasn't nearly as much fun.
I was going to say that.
But the Air Force guys loved that one. They loved going down low and catching fire and then calling in fighters on them, you know. I mean, shooting at a FAC was like, I was out with a guy. We had a guy named Captain Jones, and we were out in an O2, which was a little push-pull, weird little airplane. I think a Huey would actually outclimb them, but we're in there, and it was a side-by-side seating thing. He's flying, and I was out there, and we're way out in the mountains, and he was down way too low, and we caught some fire from an AK-47, and he called 6 sets of fighters in on this guy and dumped all their ordnance because it made him mad because they fired at him. You know, they were supposed to be smart enough not to fire at a forward air controller plane.
Right.
And then we flew back down, and the guy shot at us again. I mean, missed him. I mean, they dropped bombs. They've strafed. I mean, so we came back down there, and he fired at us again. It really made him mad. He said, okay, I'm going to go in really low, and I want you to shoot out your window, and I'll shoot out mine. Well, that was totally against regulations, and if we're coming back, we're picking up brass and throwing it out the windows, and we missed one piece. But the funny thing is, the third time we went back, the guy didn't shoot at us. Now, I'm sure we didn't hit him, but he just decided it probably wasn't worth it anymore, you know.
Right.
And so he got grounded for a month and had to, you know, go around in a Jeep.
Because
shooting out the window, yeah.
How did they find out about that?
Well, there was a piece of brass still in the plane, and somebody saw it. I'm sure it wasn't one of the regular maintenance people that reported him. But
what's this casing doing in the airplane?
I remember one time, you know, when you're first new, you don't understand things, and you used to drop white phosphorus grenades out of them to mark things, and the white phosphorus grenades that we used in the field were all timed. You know, they were on a 4.5-second fuse, the ones they used out of the airplanes were point detonating. So when they hit the ground, you know, they went off. And I didn't know the difference. And I was out with this Army warrant officer. We were in an O-1, and we saw an NVA base camp out in the mountains. They were pretty sure it was, and he wanted to mark it. So when we came around again, we didn't have the spot. And he said, have any white phosphorus? And I said, sure. And he said, when I tell you, you drop it. And I said, okay. So I'm holding this grenade out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells me to drop it, and, you know, about 4 seconds later, the thing explodes, and I don't know if you know anything about a white phosphorus grenade, but they actually throw white phosphorus further than you can throw them. The average person can throw them anyway. You have to throw it and run backwards.
Right.
And of course, this white phosphorus came shooting up past the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just livid. I mean, I don't blame him, but he didn't realize that there were two kind of white phosphorus grenades, and neither did I. I thought he knew what I was doing, and he thought I knew what I was doing. And so from then on, I found the right kind. You know, I didn't bring my own. So
right, right.
How
was it being shot at in an airplane?
I hated it. It's absolutely scary because, I mean, the tracers look like they're basketballs by the time. I read that someplace else, but it's absolutely true. They start off being little pinpricks, and they seem like they're getting bigger. And there's no place to, you know, you can't duck. I mean,
right.
if you're not flying, you're not even in control of which way you're going to, you know, dodge and weave. I just did not like being shot at an aircraft at all. I didn't like being shot out on the ground particularly, but at least you always, after a while, after you've been shot at a couple of times, as you're walking, you knew where the next divot was or the next tree. I mean, you always had an idea of what you were going to do if somebody opened up on you.
Mm-hmm.
And as an airplane, you're just sitting up there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a good feeling. And being a helicopter driver would have been a bad job, I think. But it was not as bad as being a grunt. They talk about all this stuff, but it was amazing how many of the grunts wanted to be door gunners because it was so much safer.
Right.
And so even though you were up there and getting shot at, and it was really scary from a personal standpoint, mm-hmm. you knew it was going to be over pretty quick, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Now, you would fly, every other day or so?
Oh, a lot of times I flew every day, sometimes twice a day.
Okay.
And we'd go out and fly for an hour or 2 hours and then come back in. I'd do paperwork or do something, but that was part of the deal. A lot of times I'd fly the fixed-wing missions in the morning. They'd come down from Chulai,
mm-hmm.
and we'd fly. And that wasn't every day, but then we'd fly the observation helicopters almost every day. We can go out and do some sector or do something.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we'd been getting some intelligence from someplace, we'd go out and check it out, you know, just
right.
to see if we could see anything out in that area, if anything looked weird.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, well, the whole rest of the time I was in Vietnam. In the last month or so, I found a couple of LERPs that wanted to go out and thought it would be cool to do it, so I let them do it. but I flew some of the critical missions, but some of the just routine stuff, I let somebody else that, you know, had an eye about what was going on the ground. And that was the thing. I was about the only person on the brigade staff that had ever been on the ground in the area of operation.
Was that a problem?
I think it's a problem. Of course, I was only a first lieutenant, so what did I know? But,
right.
They actually, some of them had never even, hadn't been to Vietnam before, and they actually thought that the NVA acted like they would teach us in training and would be on the high ground, you know, or up in the mountains rather than down where the streams were.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's just a pretty, they would take American military tactics and try to put them on to the Vietnam, you know, the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't work very well, usually.
Was it frustrating for you?
A little bit. Depending on who we had a brigade commander for a while that was very frustrating. He was getting his ticket punched. He was why not name names? Colonel John Donaldson. I think he was a VMI. He was one of the a grad from one of the military schools back east, and he was an up and comer. But he'd never done anything except been a general's aide or on some general's staff.
Mm-hmm.
His whole career, missed the Korean War, and then really, I don't think he'd ever even been a platoon leader. He'd always been assigned to some staff or an aide job, and he was very interested in making general.
How did you know he was a ticket puncher? Did he? This is just by his actions, his words?
Yeah, yeah, just this. He looked like a soldier. He let everybody know that he was on the fast path. I mean, he was very impressed with himself, and it was, he spent a lot of time looking good whenever, you know, making sure he was, it was, you know, every time some general officer would show up, he would be there.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, one time we were having a lot of action, and General Cooksey, who was the division assistant commander for maneuver, showed up and wanted a briefing, and I did the normal S2 briefing, the nightly briefing and thing. That was part of my duty. And so I was in there, and I'd started the briefing, and we were getting a lot of action. This was in the spring of 69. Matter of fact, we were getting most of the action in Vietnam at that time. And all of a sudden, Colonel Donaldson, who'd been out where this combat was going on, somebody told him General Cooksey had landed and gone into the briefing tent, and he comes running in, and I'm telling, you know, giving him the staff, and he said, "I'll take over now." And then General Cooksey said, "No, I want to hear what this man has to say. This is his job. I want to know what he thinks." And he says, "Now, where do you think the 22nd NVA is?" And I said, "Well, on the map we're showing them here, that's coming from division. We usually posted the maps by whatever division intelligence told us that we were supposed to do."
Mm-hmm.
That's how Colonel Donaldson wanted it, because those people up there knew what they were doing. They had all these people. And he said, "Well, where do you think they are?" And I said, "I think they're out here on the coast," because we've been getting this information and stuff. And I said, "We haven't had any sightings." And Colonel Donaldson just went nuts after the general left, and just as badly as I was ever reamed in the Army. And the next day, Charlie Company ran into the 22nd NVA division, regiment on the coast. And, but, you know, that was his deal. You know, he was somebody who was worried about kill ratios and the numbers, you know.
Right.
Every time when he came in, he, one of the assistant S1s would talk to him about what he was doing and try to write him up for some kind of a medal, because it was, important for him to, you know, to look good when he came out of this command position.
Mm-hmm.
And he did make general not too long after that. And then I understand he was the first general officer to have court-martial charges brought against him since the Civil War. One of his command and control chopper people turned him in for shooting civilians out of the Charlie.
Mm.
And he was reduced back to his permanent grade of colonel, I think, and asked to resign.
Wow.
So he was just a dink hunter. I mean, that was what we, you know, that's what, sometimes you had those people who were in helicopters and he ran around looking for trouble, you know.
Right.
And then the next guy that came in was Colonel Thompson, and he worked his way up from private and had the Medal of Honor from World War II and a DSC from Korea. And,
wow.
And he was a great guy to work for, because I mean he understood, you know, what was going on, and he understood soldiers, and I really liked him. Some of the other people didn't like him as well, because if he didn't think you were doing a good job, he'd get you out of there, because it hurt soldiers if you weren't confident.
Right.
He also fired the assistant S1 that was writing up Colonel Donaldson all the time. The guy came in, didn't know anything about him, hadn't done his homework, and about the third day he showed up to ask him what he'd been doing. He says, "Why are you so interested?" And the guy told him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "In that infantry brass on your collar?" And this guy said, "Yes, sir, but I've always been an adjutant." And he said, "Not anymore." And he put him out on some godforsaken fireplace for a long time, not doing anything important, but just got him out of there. So I really liked him, actually.
What were your briefings like?
We would go in every evening at, you know, a certain time, unless something was coming on and it happened. And we had a big map of the, it took up a whole wall in this tent kit of the area of operations, and had a big piece of plexiglass over it, and this fluorescent lights coming along the side. So when you write on with a grease pencil, it would glow. You could see through it. It was really kind of, at that time, it was, you know, high tech stuff, right?
Right.
So I would go in, take all the day's reports. I would report anything. I'd report the weather, anything about enemy forces that we knew, any contacts that had taken place and what happened during the day and the night positions of the U.S. units.
Mm-hmm.
And then the S3 would take over, the operations officer, and he would report, what the plan was for the next day, what they expected the enemy to do, that kind of stuff.
To whom were you reporting?
I reported to the brigade commander, the brigade executive officer, the brigade staff, and anybody else that might be in there, like if they had a battalion commander or whoever was in there, or, so any visitors that might be there. So we just did this nightly briefing every night, and then the S4, who, the supply people, whoever would come on then after that. So you kind of, a daily operational report and what was going on for the next day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then if we had some visitor pop in during the day, like I say, Colonel Donaldson, we had visitors usually like to do the reporting but it was kind of funny because the major who was, and sometimes the lieutenant colonel who was the operations officer always did the briefings, but on the S2 shop, I always did the briefings because the major didn't like to do them, so. So that was, and that was kind of fun. It was kind of fun because you knew what was going on. You'd have to go over and check where everybody was and things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really enjoyed my time in the intelligence shop just because it was, it was mentally challenging kind of, and you got to do some stuff that was kind of fun. And,
mm-hmm.
Doing B-52 strikes was always great.
Calling in the B-52s.
Yeah, and we finally, we never would hit anything because about the time that you'd have to ask for them several a long time in advance, and the DMZ and down around Saigon got first crack at them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we'd actually get one, the South Vietnamese, we had to go through the South Vietnamese, and they'd usually let somebody know, and we'd never get anything.
Right.
And a couple of times we got diverts. Because of weather or whatever,
right.
It wouldn't be weather. I don't know why they divert them, but because I wouldn't think weather would affect a B-52. But the and then we usually get something because they hadn't had time to warn the NVA to get out of the way.
Right.
So it was, but it was it was a big long involved thing. And once you got something, the Air Force loved you. If you had some kind of a bomb damage assessment where you could actually prove you hit something, they were just, at that point on, you were just golden with them, They were just, Air Force was, they just loved, getting reports that they'd hit something, so.
Right. I imagine that was very frustrating, the fact that you had to go through the South Vietnamese.
Yeah, it really was, because I do think that we could have done a lot more with the air power if we wouldn't have had to do that. Because they really were, we used to get we'd have a communications detachment there. They were all inside this little wire compound, inside the compound, and they were all, they were tied in with NSA somehow. They couldn't talk about what they did, but we'd have this lieutenant that would come in every day, and he'd mark these little, on our brigade intelligence map, and then we'd put them on the briefing map, the little circles with an X in it, they would say URI for usually reliable intelligence. And of course, you knew they were radio intercepts. And sometimes they'd actually even identify the unit with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, if they thought it was a headquarters and they had reason to believe that. And so you'd get these clusters of these URIs. And that was usually pretty good information, for 2 or 3 days, all of a sudden you get these intercepts from the same area that something was there. About the time we'd get a bomb mission set up for the next day or something, all of a sudden the next day you'd see these things start moving out.
Right.
The boxes, And so,
right.
So obviously somebody was telling them, and we had to go through the 1st Division headquarters at Quang Nai to have anything approved. So.
Was there any attempt to, not go through the Vietnamese?
We weren't allowed to do that. It's like the R&D area there along the highway. If you got fired at out of there, you were supposed to get permission to fire back.
Mm-hmm.
And, sometimes you did, and sometimes you just couldn't wait. And then you'd get written up, they'd send you this little thing. You shouldn't have done that. Right. And and then they'd usually take a unit that had done that, and they'd move them out in the mountains or something for a while. You know, mm-hmm. they'd punish you.
Right.
Although I'm not sure it's punishment, but, you know, it's certainly a little, you know, each one had its own little peculiarities about what was tougher about mm-hmm. operating that area. Mm-hmm. But, and then we had, you know, and life in the rear was just, you felt kind of guilty. I mean, almost like, you know, you'd abandoned people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we used to hate all the people in the rear when we were in the field, and you know, call them rimps and different mm-hmm. things. And in the R1, and you feel really bad about it, but the other thing you feel is that you probably are going to make it home. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the 35 men I had in my platoon when I first got there. In the 4 months I was in the field, we had 3 men killed and 27 wounded. So your chances are, you know, your chances at that time of getting out in one piece weren't real good if you're a line unit. And that's what I always wondered, you know, when they talk about casualty figures, if anybody ever did a figure on the line units, because they always act like Vietnam was all one deal. You know, you weren't safe in the rear. Rear was the best place in the world to be, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we'd have problems. You know, we couldn't get supplies, and the rear was just overrunning with, you know, like poncho liners, and they would send guys out to the field with blankets instead of poncho liners. Mm-hmm. And the people in the, you know, there was just a lot of resentment by the field troops, and I think that's probably the case in every war. I don't think Vietnam was unique in that, certainly it went on there.
Mm-hmm.
And so after you get back to the rear, and, you know, you go up, we had a little tiny officers club, you know, a little tent kit thing with an awning and a patio, and they'd have steaks up there sometimes, and we'd have little movies and, you know, and stuff, and you know, you'd go up there, you know, have a couple of beers, watch a movie, and then go back and work some more if you were in the intelligence shop or something, because there was always something to do, and then go to bed.
Mm-hmm. What were your quarters like?
We had tent kits, which were, you know, had wooden floors, they were raised up off the ground, about halfway up they'd be wood, and then they'd be screen wire above that, and then they'd have canvas tops in the tent. You know, they're actually the size of a GP large or a GP small or something, only you had, you know, and one I lived in, it was divided off, I think it was a GP large, and there was like 5 or 6 guys in there, and we had, there was a little tiny corridor down the middle of it, and you had little half walls and screens up, and you had a little kit, and, you know, I had a cot and a locker in there, you know, and you didn't spend a whole lot of time there, but I mean, it was pretty nice. It'd get hot, and, you know, and when it got warm, they'd be pretty warm, but, you know, they were open. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have sandbags usually halfway up, you know, to above where you were sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Around the outside, right. And then, you know, of course, the talks and some of those places were bunkered in pretty good, the tactical operations centers, you know, sometimes they were dug underground and with, you know, all kinds of stuff over the top of them. And then there were bunkers spread throughout the living area so you could run down. They were usually dug down into the ground and were all covered with sandbags and stuff, so you could run in there when we were getting rocketed or mortar attacks.
Tell me about that. How often did that happen?
It was real when I first got there in December. Oh, I bet we went, I mean, we'd go weeks without getting around into the perimeter. And of course, that was a big camp, so sometimes somebody would get one way up to the other end. And then in Tet 69, we started getting hit pretty often. As I said, we were taking a lot of the casualties for the whole country in like from about March till, you know, but there was a period in 69 where we were just getting hit really hard. The NBA came out onto the coastal plain and were really active. And I mean, we went, I think it was in March, right after Tet 69 started, we were getting hit in the daytime and at night, we'd take, you know, 140, 150 rockets a night sometimes.
Wow.
And, and then it would let off for a while, and then it started up again like in May or so. We start more mortar fire then rockets. We'd kind of take care of the rockets. We had kind of a coup during that time, and one of the outfits ambushed an NVA patrol, and they brought the there was a guy with them that had a bunch of paper and a map. Matter of fact, I still had the map. I brought it home with me. It had an NVA map of Quang Ngai Province, and there was all these places marked on it, not on the map itself, but on a overlay on it. And then he had a whole bunch of information in there, and it turned out we got it translated pretty fast, and they were the sites for the rocket launchings
They
were coming in. And it turned out he was the intelligence officer for one of the regiments of the 2nd or 3rd NVA division.
Mm-hmm.
And so we pre-plotted these places with artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And when they lit them off, all of a sudden we hit them all.
Mm-hmm.
And got all kinds of stuff from that. I mean, you know, just lucky, you know, secondary explosions going off and
right. All
kinds of things. And that was just a sweet deal.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't happen. You didn't luck out like that very often.
What was it like being woken up in the middle of the night by mortar attacks, rocket attacks?
It pretty much like getting shot at in the field. And you get so where you can hear things, whether it's friendly fire incoming or outgoing. So basically it would be real scary. You'd be asleep there, and the next thing you know, you'd be on the floor moving. I mean, you just rolled out of bed and took off. And now the people that had been in the rear the whole time weren't usually quite that good. They'd, set up or they'd jump out of bed or something. You could tell the people that had been in the field compared to the people that had been in the rear. I had a friend came down and spent, when we were having some trouble down there, came down from Camp Eagle, the 101st, which I guess was a huge place. And he couldn't sleep all night because, he was down there for about 4 days because there was outgoing artillery all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And people shooting from the perimeter, and I would sleep right through that stuff. And we were there, I think, about the third night in this, but I was looking really bad, big bags under his eyes and stuff because he can't sleep. And about the third night we were there, an AK-47 started up out in the perimeter, and they had a little probe out there. And I was out of bed and moving, and by this time the guy was so tired, he was just sleeping, right? And I had to pull him out.
Wow.
And get him going, and he couldn't believe that you could tell the difference while you were asleep,
Mm-hmm. What kind of trouble was going on? You said that he came down.
They were probing the perimeter. When I said there was trouble, we were getting rocketed and stuff at night, and so they were shooting a lot of H&I, harassment interdiction missions with the artillery and things, and so. So we had a colonel's mess, and the food was great there, and it was air conditioned. That was nice. I mean, things in the rear were just were fairly livable, other than the fact that you couldn't go anywhere. Had a little PX. They had a barber shop. They had the Koreans ran everything. They had some kind of a concession from the U.S. government as part of bringing the two Korean divisions down to run the concessions all these places and all the like brigade size bases and everything. The Koreans ran the little PXs and the barber shops and all that stuff, and there was actually Korean nationals in there doing all that work. And as I was leaving, I noticed in Duck Po and at LZ Bronco, back in one of the little, in between one of the little ridges on this big mountain, they were putting up this cement block building, which was the only one that I'd seen. And I was asking somebody what was going on, and the Koreans had gotten a concession to put a steam bath in. One of the other things that got weird, I mean, it just seemed like it got weird the longer, as I was leaving, it just seemed like it was weird. Mm-hmm. They brought in some guys from Atlantic and Pacific Engineering Company to teach the Vietnamese how to fight fires. And they were in charge of they were supposed to take over the firefighting functions at our brigade base camp, and they wanted these Vietnamese to be in there at night. Mm-hmm. And we had a huge fight about whether we were going to let the Vietnamese be in there. And these guys were, I think there was three of them. One of them was about a 20-year-old guy, and he was drawing all kinds of money, and nobody could figure out why he wasn't drafted. He was like 4F or something, supposedly. He's over there, you know, with the rest of us working a radio,
right,
making a ton of money, you know. And those guys were not real well accepted. And the colonel finally, you know, just told him, hey, there's 3 o'clock, they all leave. And they called MACB because, you know, they couldn't do their contract and stuff. And Colonel Thompson had actually served in Abrams' battalion in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And got a direct commission while he was with him. And so they were buddies. And so he just called Creighton Abrams and said, look, I'm not letting these guys on my brigade. And he said, you're the commander. You do what you want. So so that it was pretty nice having somebody had contact like that, because he'd pick up the phone every once in a while when things were going really bad and we weren't getting any support from the South Vietnamese there. And to pick up the phone and call General Abrams, and he'd come out of a meeting or whatever if he called.
Wow.
It was kind of an interesting situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he didn't do that often. You know, you just don't do that. But,
right.
But actually, the whole chain of command showed up in Duck Fo one time while Colonel Thompson was there, because Creighton Abrams came. When we were having all this contact, all of a sudden he showed up. And I've got a picture of them all coming out of the briefing room. the commander, the vice commander, all the division commander, all these guys right in a row coming down the steps.
John, you want to go ahead and stop for today?
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
So that'd be fine.
This is Dr. Richard Barone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. John McNown, Jr. Today is January 30th, 2004. It's about 8:33 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. And, John, you were again in in Mission, Kansas.
All right.
Let's pick up where we left off a couple days ago, John. We were talking about your time back at Brigade, and I had a couple questions about your intelligence gathering. I wanted to clarify or kind of delve into a little bit deeper. When you went out on these recon missions, and what was your judgment of how good the NVA and the Viet Cong were of hiding from you and disguising themselves and actually evading the intelligence gathering process?
I thought they were very good for the most part. It was very difficult to find, especially from the air, to see where their camps were back in the mountains. I mean, really did a great job of, you know, finding places back in the trees and streams that were covered, so when they were going down to get water, you wouldn't see them moving. They had great light discipline. I mean, you just never saw fires and things. You would run into them, if they were prepared, they were very difficult to find and very difficult to hide. Their main problem was they didn't have very good communications. I know that we would find things like, after our engagements at Hawthorne, one of the units found a big sand table that they had made that everything was just almost in proportion, and they'd obviously been going over the attack on the Special Forces camp, you know. And once they started, it appeared that they had no way to modify or alter the plan. That when one part of it wasn't going correctly, well, the rest of them would continue with whatever the original plan was, and of course that was often their undoing.
Right.
But they were very good at hiding their camps and their movements. I mean, they did a lot of their movements at night with good light discipline most of the time. So, but they had the same problems we did. You know, the soldiers would talk when they were moving through the jungle and stuff. And I know they had a tendency to use trails just like we did. You know, I mean, the NVA were in some ways more similar to the U.S. forces in that, you know, that even though they may have been down here for a long time, it was still not, you know, their home ground necessarily. And especially when they would come out onto the coastal plain, they were having to rely on either maps or our guides to get them to where they were going. So, they had, some of the same problems we did with that, without the technological, you know, advantages. the whole business, especially there in Quang Nai, of trying to gather intelligence is, well, like I say, once again, I don't, from what I've read since and my experience at the time, is the population was sympathetic to the North Vietnamese, and therefore, you know, we just didn't get very good intelligence often on the people, and so they were, it was really difficult to pin down what was happening around us sometimes.
Right. How much of an advantage do you think they actually had being in there and fighting in Vietnam in their own backyard, per se, as a lot of people have talked about that? It was a huge disadvantage for us. But when you were there gathering intelligence, you were there on the ground commanding troops, how much of an advantage do you think they actually had?
I don't think, I think their primary advantage was our lack of intelligence about what they were doing. Of course, it doesn't seem to have improved much, you know, in the last 30 years and reading the papers. But I don't think they had a huge advantage as far as terrain. You know, some of the things I read in books and things really wasn't my experience. I think their main advantage was probably in morale and just the sense that we were invaders and you know, the advantage that probably gives you as far as the reason that you're over sacrificing for something.
Right.
And then the population, the local population, certainly in Quang Nai, was really good at putting out booby traps and sniping, and they had, and as far as that part of the equation goes, they had a big advantage over us because they did know the ground, and they normally initiated the attacks. With the NVA, we often ended up in sort of meeting engagements. And it you know, at that point, really nobody has an advantage. They had an advantage primarily if we would, you know, walk into one of their pre-prepared positions. And then, of course, and if they would do that to us, we had a huge advantage. So, I mean, I really didn't feel that the NVA had a big advantage as far as fighting on their home ground, because they weren't. I mean, you know, they were from the north, most of them. And,
right.
And by the time I got there, the Viet Cong were, you know, I got there after '68, and the Viet Cong really weren't as big. You know, their forces had been pretty much decimated
in
early '68 and mid '68, and so we ran into Viet Cong very seldom. Most of what we ran into there were very small units, and you know, 4, 5, 6 people, and booby traps and snipers, a lot of that. But
but
as far as actual fighting goes, I didn't think the NVA had a big advantage over us, other than I do think they were better informed about our movements than we were about theirs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John, were you ever wounded?
Twice.
Okay. Can you, and I think we touched on that a little bit. How did you deal with death on the battlefield and in general, and being in that environment for that amount of time?
I think in my case, I mostly vacuumed it. And you don't really do that, but you do it as much as you can, I think. I think that I pretty much, once somebody was dead and we put them off on the chopper, I didn't think about it much.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially out when I was in the field. I mean, you took care of them, you got them out of there, and then you didn't think about it. I mean, that to me, that was how I got through the deal. And I didn't dwell on looking at people that were hit and stuff. We turned them over to the medic and went to do something else. And I guess everybody deals with that differently. In retrospect, I think about the two or three instances we had where we had some contact for a while with dead people. I think those probably bother me as much as where we had to watch over bodies for a while, and mm-hmm. you know, and things had happened, and suddenly you were around them for a while, and mm-hmm. I remember those things, and I think vividly, but who knows whether it's vividly or not? You know, your memories change as they've proven more and more. So sometimes, you know, what I think happened may not be what happened, and you may, you know, get that in with, you know, movies you've seen or something. I don't think I have, but I do know we've had several cases where we are in some pretty intense combat, and I frankly only kind of flashingly remember seeing anybody hit or mm-hmm. wounded, you know. And a lot of times you don't actually see them because you're so busy. You almost have tunnel vision, looking to your front or to wherever you're looking for, and you know, trying to preserve yourself and give orders, that when people get hit, it's just sort of out of the corner of your eye, and you're still doing something different.
Right.
And I would think somebody like a medic or, you know, somebody, I never had a really close personal friend that was hit when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I had people that were hit that were my people, and you know, and I was responsible for them, and I to this day I don't feel good about that. You always think about, I mean, you sometimes play the tape recorder over and say, well, could I have done something differently, you
mm-hmm.
know. But I do know people that you know, or had friends that, you know, they were shared a foxhole with or something for 6 months, and all of a sudden they would get taken out, and that was a really traumatic thing,
right,
for those people. And I've seen that happen to guys, you know, just pretty much break down on, you know, when somebody got hit. Usually if you're in a firefight, you don't see that. It's usually, you know, from a booby trap or a sniper where you have just an isolated thing, and all of a sudden people have, you know, they have time to sit there and think about it or mourn, or, you know, where there's something going on. So it's, I think that may be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was fortunate enough that the two times I was hit, neither time was serious enough that, you know, I would spend any time in the hospital or anything. And,
right.
all it did was make me angry. You know? So it's kind of like, you know, getting hit in the nose on the football field or something. I mean,
uh-huh.
it was more serious than that, but, it, you know, it's same kind of reaction. You just think that, you know, you feel just kind of angry, somebody, you know, somebody hurt you, and you weren't doing anything to them. You know, what's the deal? So
right.
Wow. So
when you think back to your time in the field, do you see when you think about brave incidents or bravery in general, what do you see? What do you feel?
I think that there was a great quote from I think it may have been the Major Winters in the Band of Brothers at the end of the show, where they were interviewing several of them.
Yes.
And he said one of his grandchildren asked him if he had been a hero, and
mm-hmm.
he said, I served with a company of heroes. And I think that's probably how most people that were in a good unit feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that over the years I've felt that we don't do a good job in the American Army. We spend I don't think we recognize that fact in the enough that we sometimes give out valor awards to people who may or may not deserve them, and a lot of, you know, privates and corporals and people, because of the individual actions, and nobody sees them, or there's not time, don't get written up. That
mm-hmm.
There's often officers have a chance to get written up in non-coms more than, I think, than PFCs or Spec 4s, who probably do a lot of the work, you know,
mm-hmm.
as far as going above and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know in our own company, we used to never write people up for bringing wounded back under fire. I mean, that was expected, and I got out of the field and found out that people got written up for that, and I felt bad that we didn't do it, because it is, you know, but that was just expected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody was hit, we expected somebody to go out, we put out a cover fire, and somebody had to go out and get them. That was just what you did, you know. And I when I got back and found out that people were getting silver stars and things for that, I was incredulous. Because that was just in Alpha Company, that was just your job. And I know we've got several men, that I know we should have written up for Valor Awards and didn't. And so I always kind of reconcile that after the fact with the fellow I told you, Colonel Thompson, had the Medal of Honor in the DSC and stuff, and risen up through the ranks. And he said to me one time, he said, well, you know, the only thing that matters is whether somebody's wearing a combat infantryman's badge. Mm-hmm. He said, because so many people don't get recognized for what they do. And he says, anybody that's wearing a CIB, the reason it goes above the Medal of Honor and every other award is because it recognizes the fact that infantrymen don't, get the recognition they should get. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's sitting above everything else. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, if you see somebody with a combat infantryman's badge, then that's really all that matters.
Right.
And of course, in some ways it's not, but, certainly the people I know with the Medal of Honor, did things that were just incredibly brave. So anyway, but I do think that, as far as Valor Awards go, there's too many given to people that may not deserve them, and there's not enough given to the ones who might have.
Okay. Did you know the exact date you were leaving?
I knew pretty close. I don't know if I knew to the day. I had a day in mind that I thought I was leaving, and I think I ended up leaving a day or so earlier than that. Because a lot of it had to do with when you left the States and different things. I got a 2-week drop, so I spent 11 months, two weeks in Vietnam because I'd been to Panama before going to Vietnam, which was sort of an interesting thing. It shows that, if your parents have been in the service, you know how to manipulate the system. Even though I hadn't really gone directly from Panama to Vietnam, which was what the rule had been written for, that if you left there and then left Panama and went to Vietnam, you got this 2-week drop. I was on orders to go to Vietnam when I went to Panama, and even though I had like 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks of leave before I went to Panama, and then almost a month after I came home, it still counted on my time because I was on orders to have left one post and report to Vietnam.
Right.
So I ended up knowing within a day or two when I was going to go. So yeah, I think most people did that.
Okay. Can you tell me about those last few days, that last week you were in country?
Oh, yeah. About the last 2 weeks I was there, I started sleeping in a bunker. We'd been getting shelled, in June, and I left in the middle of July. And there was a bunker right outside the S2 shop at Duck Pho there. And I got myself a fan and a cot, and I just kind of moved into this bunker because we were getting shelled and stuff often enough. I thought, well, I'm just too really close. And I mean, as you got to where you could see, and about the last month, I flew VR missions as infrequently as possible. We'd get one of the LERPs or somebody that wanted to go out and fly around. Everybody loved flying in helicopters if you weren't going in on combat assault. So you could get somebody to go out and do the mission for you, and they thought it was really cool, to be able to go up there and fly around and look for stuff. And it was always people that, like I said, usually people from our long-range patrol. One of the squad leaders or the platoon leader, I'd have do that for me.
Okay.
And I just sitting there waiting to get on a helicopter and get out of there about my last, 2 months. Last 2 weeks, I really got got pretty nervous. And I remember fellows that, you know, when I was in the field, they were getting short. Mm-hmm. And you know, they kept wanting to figure out some way they could get a job in the rear for the last month or so. And mm-hmm. and so I appreciated that a lot more as I got short. Mm-hmm. You just think, okay, I got through all of this, and all I've got is another 2 weeks, and I'm out of here, you know. So, mm-hmm.
Were the men around you supportive of your actions to kind of lay low?
I didn't really, you know, I did my job and everything.
Of course.
Just, instead of sleeping in my, sleeping in tent at night, I decided I was going to go down and sleep in a bunker. And yeah, everybody thought that was just reasonable. I think everybody started doing, you know, I mean, when people got short, they just started, finding ways not to not do their job, but just to try to avoid danger as much as they could, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that I don't know if they were supportive or not, it was just such a common thing that mm-hmm. I don't think anybody thought anything about it. They just thought, well, they're getting short and good for them, you know.
Right.
I mean, everybody was really happy. When somebody got a job out of the field, if you were in a rifle company, everybody shook hands with him and was really happy for him. You didn't
mm-hmm.
see any resentment from the people in the field on people going to the rear that had been in the field.
Right.
They resented the people in the rear, but they thought it was wonderful if somebody, you know, something happened, as long as it was a good person. You know, occasionally you wanted somebody out there because they weren't very good in the field. But,
mm-hmm.
It was really kind of a joyful thing for somebody to make it out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty much that way, even in the rear areas. When people were going home, people were just happy for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and of course, like I say, by 69, we knew we were going to pull out eventually, you know, so.
Right.
And had a funny experience as I was going home.
Mm-hmm.
I picked up on, in fact, I'm not even sure I remember getting on the airplane once I got to Da Nang. I remember landing in SeaTac, but I'm not even sure I remember taking off from Vietnam. But but when I was flying up to Chu Lai from Duc Pho,
mm-hmm.
I got up just north of Quang Ngai City. We were flying out, and I hadn't been up. A lot of times the VR didn't take us up north. We usually went out west, and because of all the action was south of the Song Tre Cuc River had been, and that was our area. That's where mostly where I flew, and I hadn't been up north of Quang Ngai City for a couple of months, and I got up there, and Highway 1 was paved.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. I was just incredulous that they'd paved the highway, because half of what we did was trying to keep that road open. It was dirt. And I found out that I guess coming through the 11th Infantry Brigade area of operations, it was one of the last pieces of the road they got paved.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been paving from the south and paving coming down from the DMZ. And because the NVA and the Viet Cong were so active in Quang Ngai, and one of the things they kept trying to do was blow the bridges and, you know, keep the roads closed,
mm-hmm.
keep Highway 1 closed,
mm-hmm.
it had never occurred to me that you could pave it. I mean, it just didn't occur to me. I thought, well, maybe we're doing better than I thought we were. You know, that was one of my last thoughts as I was leaving, you know, that they've paved the road. I mean,
right.
That seemed like progress. Well, it turned out it wasn't, but, you know, It was just an incredulous thing to me
mm-hmm.
that the road was paved. So,
mm-hmm. What was that flight home like?
You know, I'm sure it was long. I don't remember much. I remember people both on my R&R flight to Australia and coming out of Da Nang going home. People cheered when the plane lifted off. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we had pretty decent food, and it's just a really long flight.
Mm-hmm.
I remember landing at SeaTac. Like I said, that's the main thing I remember from. I remember being in a helicopter, seeing the road paved, and I don't remember the rest of the trip. It's funny because I remember the trip over.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember going home. I don't know how we got there. I don't know if we landed in Japan. I don't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, landing in SeaTac, and it was night, probably maybe 1 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed like it was freezing. I mean, it was in July, and it was probably in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I mean, I was just miserably cold.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to wait for a bus. They had a bus that was going to take everybody down. But if you were an officer, you could take a taxi cab. So me and 3 other lieutenants got a cab, and we went down. And it turned out that was a mistake because we didn't know where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
But we just wanted out of there. And so we went down to Fort Lewis, and we got there and couldn't find anybody that knew anything.
Mm-hmm.
And wandered around freezing for a while, and we finally saw a big line of troops going into some barracks, and the lights were on, and we could see they were barracks, and it looked like transient barracks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I walked up to the front of this line, and I thought, well, I'll just get me a bunk here and then find out where I'm supposed to go in the morning. I just wanted to get some sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sergeant first class that was sitting down. He was taking people's names and assigning bunks. And I remember that I went up and said, you know, pardon me, Sergeant, I'd like to, and he just looked up at me and said, you know, get back in line, and just started giving me a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I said, I'm a lieutenant, and he said, I don't care who you are, he says, get back in the line. And of course, I didn't feel like putting up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was sort of embarrassing, but we pretty much locked the guys, you know, stood him up and reamed him out right in front of all these guys who were going over to Vietnam, and I think they were very pleased about it because he wasn't being very nice to the guys who were coming through the barracks there either.
Uh-huh.
And he finally told us where the transient BOQ place was, and we went over and got a place to sleep then.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think he wanted us around anymore. And then, you know, took care of our business to get mustard meal through and mm-hmm. on our way home the next day. So,
what was it like going home? Did you have any problems at the airports?
No, actually, I went up to the SeaTac airport and I had all my khakis and you know stuff so I could get military space available deal. And I walked in. I was going to St. Louis and went up to pretty sure it was Continental that I flew home on And the people behind the desk were just as nice as they could be, and they stuck me in first class.
Wow.
Gave me a space available ticket and then put me in first class.
Hmm.
And, I mean, they were just awfully nice, and the people on the airplanes were nice. You know, some people, I got home, and my folks and my fiancé met me at the airport there in St. Louis, and I went home and had, you know, kind of went back to life for a while. So,
what was that like? Was it difficult to transition back into life in the States? You stayed in the military, though, right?
For another 2 years. I did something weird. I actually got out because my fiance didn't. You know, she didn't think she wanted to do that. And I went to grad school for a semester and was substitute teaching. And she was a teacher. We got married, and I got married a couple of weeks. 3 weeks after I got home, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do, and I didn't dislike the Army. I didn't want to stay in the infantry. I knew that. But I really liked my job in military intelligence. I really enjoyed doing that, and so all of a sudden I got assigned to a reserve outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. I was the only person that had been to Vietnam with combat experience that I knew that got assigned to a reserve outfit, and it was some transportation
mm-hmm.
company. And I had absolutely no desire to be a weekend warrior, and especially in a transportation outfit. So I went down and decided to talk it over and decided to go back in and get my other 2 years in at least and maybe stay in so that I could you wouldn't have any reserve obligation, and then if I decided I wanted to stay in, I could, because I really didn't have an idea of what I wanted to do.
Okay.
When I'd gone through school, what I wanted to do was be in the Army, and after 2 years, I wasn't as sure about that, but I didn't have another idea about what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down, and that was a hassle, because it turned out they turned my records, I was trying to find my records, and it was really difficult to find them because they were sort of in transition, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally got it all straightened out, and I went back in and was assigned to Fort Hood, Texas in April
mm-hmm.
of 70, and stayed in for another 2 years. And after two more years, I decided I just can't put up with this. And I couldn't get out of the infantry, and they sent me to the DMZ, and I was with the 2nd Infantry Division in Korea for 13 months as a captain, and that was just a really bad experience.
Why?
Well, drugs were very bad. It was when I got there about 2 weeks after they sent the 7th Infantry Division home, and the 2nd Infantry Division had come back off the Z, actually off the Z. We were at Camp Casey, which is where the 2nd Infantry Division still is, and that's probably 10, 15 miles south of the DMZ.
Mm-hmm.
And we were actually at Camp Hovey. I was in the 2nd Brigade, which is about 2 miles away, but they're all kind of one big place there.
Mm-hmm.
And drugs, the main reason I think they brought the American troops back off the Z, as far as I could tell, was drugs were just such a problem. They were having fraggings and shootings almost on a daily basis up there. And I think the reason they brought him back was to get the live ammunition out of the hands of the troops.
Mm-hmm.
And the discipline was just really poor there. The mission was kind of, you know what the mission was, and it was just sitting there, you know, waiting, and we'd have MiGs fly over the top of the camp every once in a while, you know, they
right.
just come streaking down to see if they could do it, and of course they could, and that made you feel really good because there was only one road out, it was, you know, it was cold in the winter, it was really terribly cold in the winter, and you couldn't go to the field very much because there wasn't many places to maneuver, so you were basically running a garrison in a place where there was nothing for the troops to do after they got off but get in trouble. And we had, just a lot of problems. I ended up being a headquarters company commandant for the brigade, and that was not a job that, I would have ever wanted. I got it by accident, the brigade commander decided he liked me. The Koreans had taken over when I was down with one of the rifle battalions, had taken over the supply area for the division,
mm-hmm.
and were wanting higher wages, and were kind of doing a set-in and threatening to burn the place and refusing to leave. So they finally decided they had to call. The MPs couldn't handle it. They decided they wanted to call infantry troops in to drive them out. And so I was the operations officer for this battalion at the time, and they sent me over first to find out what we're going to have to do, and the brigade commander was over there, and he'd been the chief of staff for the division before he'd taken over our brigade, and he knew some of these people and wanted to go in and talk to them, and he said, well, somebody go in with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, sure, I'll go in if you're going in, and nobody else volunteered. And so we went in, and he actually talked them out. I think maybe what persuaded him, the trucks had started pulling up with the troops in it, but talked them out. And the next day I get a call from him, and he wants me to come up to brigade headquarters, and hadn't gone through my battalion commander or anything. He's another guy that worked his way up from the ranks. And he'd relieved his headquarters company commandant and put me in charge. So all of a sudden I had like 300, you know, headquarters company in the brigade's a big company. And,
mm-hmm.
and they're all drivers and clerks. And, you know, I mean, I just had no experience of dealing with people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay as long as the first colonel was there, and then we got a second colonel in that thought he was Mr. NATO. He used to tell us at the Pentagon he was known as Mr. NATO, and we finally explained to him that we didn't care. There was nothing going on in Europe, and a bunch of the captains did, and that went, oh, my God, that was the end of the world. So was not a good experience for me anyway, and then I called, so I decided I was getting out, and I had the assistant division commander call me over and was going to give me a regular commission because I'd worked for him at Fort Carson, and he remembered me. And I told him, I said, you know, they're going to send me back to Vietnam next year and as an advisor, because I checked with some people, you know, to see what would happen. And I said, so I can't get a branch transfer, and I said, I can't go back to Vietnam as an advisor. I said, there's no way. And I said, it's just time for me to move on and do something else. So, so Korea turned out to be a sort of a good thing for me because it made up my mind about what I wanted to do, you know. So.
Right.
And so then I came back and got in yearbooks by accident. So that was, they were looking for people with operations experience in the Army. They were on a hire a vet kick at the company I originally went to work for. And And so I got a job, so that was a good thing. The Army did something, got me a house, you know. So that was good.
Okay. Did you talk about your Vietnam experience much? Did people ask you about it when you first came home, and then over the next few years?
Actually, you know, nobody talked about it very much. Occasionally, somebody would ask, you know, would ask something, and he'd say something. Of course, you know, it's kind of, even with people that were there in different places, you know, it was kind of a, and my thought is that it was probably that way for every war. You know, it's really good to talk to the people in your company and your group because you're at the same place where people, you know, for instance, over in the 3rd or the 1st that might have been in Ha Thanh at the same time we were, you know, that know something. But, you know, I think Vietnam was sort of a strange war, and it was different for, you know, depending on the area that you operated in. You know, I mean, the war in the Delta was completely different than the war where we were. And if you were up in the Central Highlands the whole time, it was different. You know, we were bouncing back and forth between the coastal plains and the mountains. And I think that in talking to people, it seemed like a lot of people operated in the same kind of terrain most of their tour. So, you know, there wasn't really anybody to talk to, and you're busy, you know, you just got married, you got all these things you're doing, and so, and I used to wonder, I only had contact, a couple of times with people from the company, you know, 'cause everybody, it was really hard to know what happened to everybody, because everybody's going home, and you don't necessarily, you know, remember where they were from or, you know, anything. And I had one of the fellows that had been one of my squad leaders that worked up, showed up in 1974 in Topeka, Kansas, when I lived there, called me out of the blue, and came by and spent, he was a guy that was a carpet layer, and he just decided that he was just going to wander around the company and lay, you know, country and lay carpet. And he remembered that, you know, where my folks lived, and he called them and got a hold of them. And so he came out, and he spent, you know, 3 or 4 days at my house, and then got an apartment and stayed around for a month or so, and decided he didn't like Topeka that much, and went off someplace else where he knew where somebody was. But and then I was actually eating lunch with some clients in a restaurant over there in the mid-70s, and I looked up and I kept seeing this guy, and I thought, man, he looks familiar, and I finally decided he looked like somebody on a television show, and as he walked out, I realized it was Doug Falk, one of the other platoon leaders, but, you know, his hair was longer, he was in a suit and everything, and so I ran out and I missed him. I'd walked behind him, you know, several times, and so I actually recognized him from his body, you know, from his walk, and so I saw his license plate, and he was from a county south of Topeka there, so I called the sheriff, and he would, you know, of course, the sheriff, I told him what the deal was, and he said, well, I can't give you the number, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go out and see him, and you give me your number, and so he called, and we got together a few times, and then he ended up moving someplace else, but but other than that, I didn't really have any contact with anybody until probably the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a list of people, and I wondered what happened to them. I wasn't sure where all they were from, and it wasn't a good way to look for people then. But anyway, in the late 80s, the AmeriCal Division Veterans Association had a meeting in Topeka, because at that time the guy that did the newsletter was from there, and he volunteered to do it. And, of course, mm-hmm. not a whole lot of people showed up, but I saw something in the paper. I didn't even know they had an organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over for the banquet the first night, and there wasn't anybody there I knew. There wasn't, you know, there might have been 150 people there was all, maybe. A battalion commander from the 3rd to the 1st and his operations officer were there, and I sort of had met them. I knew who they were. But I got to looking through the rolls, and there was two names there from my platoon. One guy named Damon Bazigan, who was wounded in October, and we never saw him again, but there's a easy name to remember, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there can't be too many Damon Bazigans in the AmeriCal Division. And so I was able to get in touch with him and a guy named Louis Rios, who I thought was dead, and I'd looked for his name on the wall I don't know how many times. I was able to get in touch with him. And then from there, we started picking up people. So since probably about 87 or 88, I've been looking for people, and I got other people looking for people. And,
mm-hmm.
And then with the Internet directories coming online, we've been able to do a lot better, and people would remember, okay, so-and-so, I think he was from Macomb, Mississippi or something, you know, and so
right.
as we would get information together, we'd start looking for people, and that's been a very rewarding thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think we now have addresses for about 390 guys. We've gotten people to send us orders so we can kind of put a roster together. The Army won't help you do that, but we've been, and I think we have a list of about 900 people that were either served in or attached to the company while we were in Vietnam. And we've found about 60 of them, have died since, you know, we came home. And of
mm-hmm.
course we had 77 killed in action in the 4 years we were over there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, now we have addresses for about 390. So we've managed to track down over half of them so far.
Okay.
And so that's pretty good. But, you know, it's amazing you think about it, because I used to tell people, I bet there'd been 1,000 people in the company, and they
mm-hmm.
just thought that was, you know, didn't think that was possible, because there's only 156 men on the table of organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think someday we will have about 1,000, you know, close to 1,000 that served in the 4 years that we were over there. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John, I need to stop for a minute to change out this mini disc.
Sure.
John, how much did you keep up with the war effort when you came home and then over the years?
I watched the news, you know, I didn't join. I'm not a joiner, you know. I just don't join things. And I don't know. And even in college, I wasn't much of a joiner, so that's just not my thing that I do. But I did keep up with the war news. You know, I watched it, and just because by the time I came home, I thought, you know, that. And I'd actually, I remember, I don't know if I mentioned this, but I actually voted on the, I voted on the 21st of September 1968,
mm-hmm.
in a foxhole at Hawthorne. I had my absentee ballot.
Right.
And I remember at the time, Humphrey, I come from a family that's very, very Democratic,
mm-hmm.
But at the time, Humphrey hadn't broken off from Johnson, and you know, Nixon said he had a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember voting for Nixon because I thought he was going to get us out of there. And maybe not me, but you know, he would be getting the people out, because by then, I mean, it was just obvious that we weren't going to win. You know, where we were, the people didn't like us. So what was the point? You know, I mean, I couldn't figure out, you know, what, you know, that it obviously wasn't worth the effort to go full bore into it, and we were going to do nothing but take casualties for, you know, and then eventually pull out. So, I mean, even in September of 68, that was obvious. So I voted for Nixon, and so when I came back, I was, you know, I was just really upset that, you know, that he didn't really seem to have a plan to get the troops out of the field, and you know, things just kept, you know, they didn't get any better, and the 69 was still a bad year, and then he finally slowly started pulling people out. But so I kept up with the stuff, and especially when they'd have something about the AmeriCal division, and usually that was not good, you know. And when the mule, I think, broke there, I think sometime in late 69 or early 70, and of course that was my battalion, so I mean that, you know, I kept up with that a lot, because I just, you know, I just couldn't believe it. At first I didn't believe it, and then I, you know, when I figured out it was true, I thought they should have hung somebody. I thought that, you know, that's just a failure of leadership at a low level, and I'm not sure, we've talked about this before, I'm not sure there was a conspiracy to hide things. I just don't think that people necessarily believed it, but I don't know who had talked to the helicopter pilots. You know, that's the thing that you don't know, but, you know, just listening to the Vietnamese, I wouldn't have believed it. So, you know, I kept up with that. And, of course, that was another reason that, you know, I think I mentioned I hardly ever wore an AmeriCal patch. I always wore an 11th Infantry Brigade patch because nobody knew what that was. And you didn't take as much flack on a different post. I mean, they were giving people that served in the AmeriCal a lot of flack for a while. The rest of the Army was. And, that, of course, now it's a big deal. Every movie you see, they've got an AmeriCal patch on. But the...
So today it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf made it a big deal. I mean, after they became famous in the Gulf War, if you go to the movies, half the people you see there supposedly, you know, are the higher ups in the movies, and the people that supposedly served in Vietnam, if you see, they've got an AmeriCal patch on, and kind of, you know, I will always love those two guys, because I think that, you know, most of the people that served in the division did, you know, were like most of the people in the other divisions. They were over there doing the best they could under difficult circumstances and trying to serve honorably, and all of a sudden we got the bad rap, and I think they sort of restored our reputation to some extent. So that's a good thing.
What do you think of the Vietnamization policy?
I didn't think it was it would work. I wish they'd done it faster and gotten us out of there. You know, there was no way the situation was going to be saved. I think it was basically something that Henry Kissinger and Nixon came up with to try to save face. That we could have made a deal with the North Vietnamese and gotten out of there and saved everybody a lot of trouble. I mean, that would be kind of a cynical way to look at it, but, you know, it wasn't, after we decided we were going home, it wasn't worth any more lives on anybody's part. I don't think, and there was no way the South Vietnamese Army was gonna, you know, was gonna win the war over there.
Right.
You know, they just were poorly led, and, you know, after 20 years, I remember we had an interpreter one time that told me that I was taking too many chances, Sergeant Waugh, that I should get behind a tree and direct men, that the war had been going on, you know, since the Japanese were there, and it would be going on long after I went home, and there was no point in getting killed.
Okay.
And I mean, so even the, you know, the South Vietnamese, you know, their motivation was, they just didn't have any. I mean, it was just, there was no real purpose. I don't know exactly how they kept the Army together as long as they did.
What did you say to this guy when he said that to you?
I said, that's not the point. I said, the point is they're my people, and that you don't, you know, you don't waste your people. My job is to be the leader and not the director. And that's how, you know, we do things. I just have a different job than they do, but we're all out here together. And so he just told me that, well, that wasn't the point, that, you know, I had a chance to go home. He didn't, and I should, you know, not do that kind of stuff. So
mm-hmm.
It was just a different outlook. And, you know, and I think, you know, Kissinger, you know, he had delusions of grandeur, I think, sometimes about, you know, about being Mitterrand or somebody, and just figured he could manipulate the situation. And the North Vietnamese were never going to be manipulated. You know, they were pretty focused on what they were going to do, and they didn't really care whether they made deals and broke them or not. And, you know, and I don't know. And I think Kissinger was sort of the same way, only he probably wasn't quite as good as they were. So,
mm-hmm. What did you think when the United States withdrew in 1973?
Well, I was happy if we got the army out of there, and that we were pulling out, because I mean it was pretty much it was a huge waste. I mean it was just a huge waste of lives and a huge amount of suffering for it. In the big picture, it may not have been a waste, and I am talking about the policy of containment. But that supposedly wasn't why we were over. I mean, we were over there as part of the policy of containment, but we were over there supposedly we were going to win the deal. We weren't supposed to be fighting for a draw. You know, you never want to tell an army, I guess, you're fighting for a draw. But that time it was just a huge waste, and the impact on the country was not worth the lives and the effort to continue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just didn't have, the government didn't have a vision that the people could accept. And at that point, you've got to look at it and say, okay, it's time to cut the losses and run. And we certainly waited about 2 or 3 years too long to do that. I think one of the worst days of my life, though, was on April 30th in 75, when we finally pulled out altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, it just seemed like I just couldn't imagine all the people that suffered through that, you know, the people here at home and the people that were in Vietnam, and then just to pull out in that way, you know, just to be forced out in the way that looked. And I remember sitting there all watching that with a bottle of bourbon, just getting drunk,
mm-hmm.
and crying. I mean, that was one of the worst days of my whole life, I think, even though I thought we should be getting out. I mean, just sitting there and watch it actually happen, you know, that whole last week or so was just almost too much to watch. Because we'd put so much into it. You know, I'd put a lot into it, and my friends had put a lot into it, you know, and it
right.
was just all a waste.
Right. I can assume that you did not think that the United States achieved peace with honor, as Kissinger and Nixon said.
No.
Okay.
We kept trying to manipulate the deal and didn't get it done, and then had to just run.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, I think in 69, Nixon could have gone in and developed a withdrawal plan, but he would have had to say that we didn't have the wherewithal to do it, and he wasn't willing to do that, and maybe
mm-hmm.
in his position, I wouldn't have been willing to do that either. We certainly didn't negotiate a peace with honor. All we did was negotiate a time frame to extend the suffering for another 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Can you give your assessment overall of U.S. policy in the Vietnam War?
I think that we started out, and I don't know if this is what you want, but I think we started out with the best of intentions. And the real feeling among the government that it was important that we protect we saved the world from communism. And there's no question that the Truman Doctrine, if that's what you want to call it, was the right thing. Communism is a terrible thing, the way that, you know, certainly the Soviets and then Chinese aberrations, I guess, of what Karl Marx was thinking. So we start off and we're going to help these people, and then we find out that, you know, the people are sort of beyond help, and we think that it's because they've got bad leaders, and we start making bad decisions. I mean, the overthrow of the DMs, at that point it should have been obvious that something wasn't right there, and that we aren't going to be able to accomplish what we want to accomplish in that, at that point. And you go all the way back to the 50s, I guess, when I guess Ho Chi Minh had made some overtures to the United States. And we pretty much rejected him because he was a communist, and I don't think that we necessarily understood that communism really wasn't a single monolithic movement, that it differed from place to place, just like democracy, you know, has different faces some places. So we start off, and then we get involved to the point that it's really our deal. And once it becomes our deal, then we don't know what to do with it, because, and by that I mean we've overthrown the government. We've aided in the overthrow of the government. And then we decide that, well, okay, we've got to go in and we've got to prop these people up. And again, I think the intent was that, that they actually believed the domino theory. And so we keep throwing people in. What the strategic value of Vietnam is, other than, or even Southeast Asia, I guess, other than there's lots of people there, and as part of the policy of containment, then you have to contain the communism every place that it tries to expand. And in the end, I think Truman was probably right. I think Vietnam was successful to the extent that it helped, extend the woes of the various communist governments in trying to support, worldwide revolution, that they finally imploded. And I think from that standpoint that if you look at the big picture as a 20th century thing, Vietnam was probably part of that whole pattern. But in the case of having a policy there, and having a strategy on how we were going to win, how we were going to succeed. I think we have a little bit of the same problem here with the war on terrorism. I don't think we understand how you succeed here. I think we're into the deal. We're looking for this guy. We're looking for that guy. We're looking for somebody. That's not probably going to get it done. And we got into the body count thing. If we kill enough of them, we'll win. They'll quit. And movements don't work that way.
Do you think the United States learned lessons from its experience?
It doesn't appear that we have. I think that we may have learned that we can't prop up governments. That may be something that we may have learned, that we can't send in military power and prop up governments. I think Iraq may be a good test for that. At least there it appears that we really do intend to turn it over to them and get out at some point, although you keep hearing we may have to have troops there for 5 or 6 or 7 years, and the longer we leave troops there, I think the worse the situation will get. There's no question that, we're an army of occupation, and nobody loves an army of occupation, except maybe the Germans, for a while, but even they don't like us that much anymore, I heard. I'm not sure that we won't be trying to repeat the same mistakes over in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we lack, what's the word I'm looking for? Xenophobic, that we're so self-centered in our look that if somebody tells us they like us, that we think it's our duty to help them instead of going in and really assessing the situation,
mm-hmm.
and saying, okay, these people aren't like us. What do we need to do in there to help them in their situation rather than have them be someplace? We're a great trading nation. We're looking for trading partners all the time, and that sometimes gets in your way. I think we still have a little bit of the Adam Smith idea,
mm-hmm.
in this, and I'm not sure in the modern world with the world having shrunk in time, the distances between places and just the way that things work, that idea that we can project power and will work in the modern world. I just don't know that we can project power and have it do what it would have done in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the United States has left Vietnam behind, or is Vietnam still with us today? Not the country itself, but just
the experience. I know what you're saying.
Okay.
I think that it's, well, obviously for a lot of the veterans, it hasn't, they're still mad at Jane Fonda, but the, I think that in the mentality of the government, and especially in the mentality of the military, it hasn't completely left us behind. I think that, matter of fact, I don't think it's left us behind at all, because I think there is a mistrust of the government that occurred during that time, that they've never gotten back. I don't think people view the government of the United States the same way that they did before Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that cynicism and the fact that the government is not working in our best interest,
mm-hmm.
is a legacy that we haven't left behind, and I don't know how you get rid of that.
Right. Tell me about your experience in Vietnam. How do you feel about it today?
I think about that a lot. You think, I don't know if there's anybody who was in combat in Vietnam that doesn't have some degree of post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that, things happen, and you'll be driving down the road and something pops back. The wind will be blowing funny, or there'll be some kind of movement. I mean, I got over, diving into ditches within a month or so when I got home.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was really embarrassing, and it's not it's not a socially acceptable thing to do. I am who I am because of being in Vietnam. And I can't really access, I don't know who I'd be if I hadn't been there.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, I just see it as another experience in my life. I do think that there are things that I see differently. There's attitudes I have that in some respects, it is kind of a central or a turning point in my life, and that a lot of what I look for in people, a lot of what I expect from my superiors, a lot of things that I do, the way that I work, have to do with my year in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it affects. I had two things. I grew up on military bases. We moved every 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to Vietnam, and I'm very, I don't know if I have made a really good friend since I came home from Vietnam.
Really?
And I think that the reason for that is that between the two experiences, growing up on military bases and always moving, and then what happened in Vietnam, I just don't trust somebody to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a consequence, I have a lot of good acquaintances and very few, if any, really good friends that I've made since I've come home from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think from that standpoint, it's, you know, it affects you, but it really does affect the way I manage people, the way that I expect to be managed, and my mistrust of upper management.
Mm-hmm.
I keep turning down jobs because I don't want to be part of that.
Really?
And it goes down, you know, it goes back to that. I have the last good job in a corporation because I'm still dealing with people.
Mm-hmm.
And you aren't dealing with just other corporate managers. And I saw that in Vietnam after I got out of the field and went up to brigade headquarters. I mean, I was just, I was just amazed at the thought process there compared to the reality of what went on in the field. And I think that's the case in any, the further away you get from people that are doing the job, the less understanding you have of what the costs are.
So in a sense, today you're still staying in the field.
Yeah, I guess in a sense I am. I set up this attitude and I still have it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of life, I think, has proved that to be true. I think the people at the top have a completely different outlook on things, and what the and what, you know, they see a plant as a profit center, for
mm-hmm.
instance. And if you need to get rid of 50 people, that's okay if the profit gets better, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like the body count mentality,
mm-hmm.
or the kill ratio mentality. I guess it'd be closer to a kill ratio mentality. And they don't look for other ways to do it because they don't see the impact of the decisions they make.
Mm-hmm.
The decisions don't personally impact them, other than the fact if the stock goes up, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vietnam, you saw that same kind of mentality. I remember doing the nightly briefings, and I'd say, okay, here's B Company, you know, 4th of the 21st Infantry is located here tonight. And they would, they'd say, and they had given them a sector that, you know, that 156 men are supposed to cover.
Mm-hmm.
And B Company, 4th of the 21st, might have only had 55 men left in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, to them, it was still B Company, 4th of the 21st. And that's all they worried about. I got a company out there. Here's a company-sized mission. You go out and do a company-sized mission. The reality was when you get down to a small enough group, then they give you a company size mission and you start finding a way to honor the letter of what they did, but not the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
That you really don't want a company size contact.
Mm-hmm.
If you're down to a platoon, you know.
Right.
So, I think that's been the case in every war, but in Vietnam, I think part of the problem was because you operated separately for so much, there wasn't any support to you on your right or your left. And you operated independently. It gave you a chance to make decisions that maybe in Korea or World War II, a company commander couldn't have made,
mm-hmm.
or a platoon leader, because, you know, you had people on your right, people on your left, people behind you.
Mm-hmm.
And in Vietnam, you never did. I mean, I remember they told us to go into a gorge one day, out in the mountains. It was triple canopy, and when we got there, I mean, this thing was, it looked like the box cane that the Lone Ranger, you know, and the
mm-hmm.
company rangers ran into when they get wiped out in the movies or
mm-hmm.
the television. And it's straight up for, you know, like 90 feet on both sides with a little stream going, and somebody thinks there's a cave in there. And we're looking down there, and we, you know, we've got, you know, 70-some guys in the company, and there's no way to go in there, and if there's somebody up on top, it's just all over for you, because there's no cover, there's nothing, there's just a stream, and this thing was probably a half a mile or close to a mile long. You could see it, you know, going down this hill, and mm-hmm. these cliffs never let up. So what we did is we went up on one side and walked down kind of the edge looking down into it, and when they'd tell us to pop smoke, we'd throw the smoke down into the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked from one end to the other, and, you know, but never actually checked the stream out, because it was just an asinine order.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no helicopter landing areas nearby. There the next closest company was, you know, like 7 or 8 clicks away through the jungle, and mm-hmm. they were 2 days away from us.
Mm-hmm.
They had to cut their way in, and, you know, and so we sort of did what they told us, but we didn't do what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there may have been more of that in Vietnam. And as I talk to other veterans, you hear the same kind of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was just, and I think to some extent, putting the leaders in helicopters caused some of that. By the battalion commanders and brigade commanders all of a sudden having this godlike overview, they lose contact with the ground, and mm-hmm. I think that's not necessarily a good thing.
Mm-hmm. What was the most important thing you learned there, do you think?
The most important thing I learned was to do your homework and be ready and to have contingency plans when things don't go right.
Mm-hmm.
And that served me in good stead all my life. I never got ambushed when I was running the company or the platoon, and I haven't been ambushed since, I don't think. And I think that the fact that you have a plan and you've got to be able to articulate the plan to the people, and if you can do that, you can make it work. You can take ordinary people and do extraordinary things if you can get them to understand what it is they're trying to do.
Right.
And I believe that.
Is there anything that you would change about your Vietnam experience, any good?
Oh, I don't know how to answer that. I can't imagine what I could have done to change it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's a lack of imagination on my part, but I just think that the one good decision I made was when I first got there, they asked me whether I wanted to go into the field or take a rear job first. I had a choice, and I said, you know, I want to go into the field first. That's why I'm over here. I want to be a platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good decision. I think if I'd been in rear for 6 months and started learning what I learned out there, I might not have been quite so anxious to find a way to wouldn't have been as thrilled to go to the field. I always felt sorry for Doug Falk, who was had been our third platoon leader, and they moved him back to be executive officer. And every time we had somebody, you know, some platoon leader hit, they had him back out in the field again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I was glad that once I got out, I didn't have to go back in. I don't think I would have looked forward to that. And I do think that the Army made a horrible mistake, though, on that officer rotation policy.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, really bad, because we had very few senior NCOs there. You know, most of the NCOs that we had in the field were either shake and bakes. They'd gone through the NCO OCS schools in Benning.
Mm-hmm.
Were fairly young guys. The older non-commissioned officers mostly found a way to, you know, to keep from going to the field. At least that was my experience. That may not have been the experience in every unit. But so you didn't have, you didn't have much backup to your officer corps in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that was a huge mistake, and they did it partially as a management tool to give more officers more command time and more combat experience, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was not good for morale of the troops, and it wasn't probably necessarily good for the effort, because about the time you learned what you were doing, you were rotating out.
Right.
And that doesn't necessarily mean I certainly didn't turn down my chance to get out of the field when it came. Although when I left, I didn't think I was getting out. I thought I was taking over another company. But that was once I got out, I didn't really have a desire to go back in. Although I had a little survivor guilt business. You know, you don't like leaving your people out there.
Right. Did you suffer any disabilities over the years from your service in Vietnam, to include the PTSD?
You know, not that I know, not to a great extent. Not to the extent that I've gone down, you know, and sought counseling or, you know, done anything else than that. But I do believe in talking to other Vietnam vets, you know, over the years and stuff. I think everybody that was in combat has some PS, you know, TD, to various extents. Some people, you know, it gets to the point that they can't operate. Some people, I've noticed over the years that I get a little depressed, it seems like, every September.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to think, well, this is kind of weird. September is a nice time of year. And I finally just think it goes back to that in September rolls around, I think about going out to Ha Thanh and that was certainly the most traumatic week of my entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we lost a lot of people out there, and I think, you know, it's every September when those days roll around, I know what days they are, and I think that, you know, so you have some of that, but I think the other people that lose people, whether it's their mother or whoever it is, you know, some people have that thing. I have a lot of, I know as we've gotten in contact with more and more people, you know, we have quite a few people in the company that I think have some severe problems. You know, they've been in counseling, they've had drug problems, alcohol problems, and some of it relates back to Vietnam, I think. And of course, then I go to the AmeriCal division, and I see these guys in the rear, and they're all getting disability and stuff for that. And you think, what's the deal there? That was the best gig you ever had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I do sometimes resent the fact, I guess, that the VA and places don't differentiate between combat veterans and other people. I mm-hmm. do think the people that actually saw action certainly have a claim to possibly having more problems than other veterans,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we recognize that to the extent that we should.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of fellows that I think have some physical problems because of their service. You know, not only people that were wounded, severely wounded, but we seem to have more and more guys that are in their 50s are getting strange types of cancers, and who knows. But I know we've had several guys die from really rapidly progressing, aggressive bone cancers that are strange cancers. And, you know, when you think that we had two from my platoon, and you think that, you know, that's doesn't seem to... That would normally occur in that small a population. And in both cases, one of them finally admitted it was Agent Orange. They were trying to deny it because we'd never been in a defoliated area, but they used defoliant every place. So I think they finally backed off on that and said anybody in Vietnam could have been exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So it only took them, 25, 30 years to do that.
Right. Right.
But I don't think that I've ever been in a place where I thought Vietnam really negatively affected either my health or my my overall mental attitude. And the only thing I found out, I can't have an MRI because I've got shrapnel in my sinus. But, you know, so they told me not to have an MRI, so I never thought about that. So
Okay. They
wanted to go in and get it, and I said, no, it's been there all this time. Just leave it alone. You know, I'm fine. So
right. John, if you had to address a group of young people about the Vietnam War and talking to high school students, college students,
yeah, I do that. I teach a high school Sunday school class, and it comes up occasionally, or in relation to the war, and, you know, in Iraq or something.
Right. What do you tell them?
Well, I tell them, number one, that the Army is not a college scholarship program. that you can't buy into that. That it's serious business, and it's not glorious business, but it's probably the finest thing you can do. But the thing you have to understand is it is dangerous. That your chances, if you go into the Marine Corps or the Army and end up being a soldier in the infantry, you're going to be dirty. You're going to be, you know, sometimes you don't eat, sometimes you don't get water. But in the end, it is the best job, and you meet the best people you ever meet. And I said, but you have to understand that it's not like television. It's not like the movies. And I said, even watching television of the Gulf War, that, you know, that most wars haven't been like that, or the Iraqi campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And that that it's not a very glorious thing to do, but, it's a good thing to do and a right thing to do if that's what you want, but don't go in there with your eyes shut.
Mm-hmm. What about Vietnam?
I tell them that Vietnam, we tried to do the right thing and it didn't work out, and we didn't have a plan, and that that the best people I ever knew were the people that I served with in Vietnam, but it's not an experience I would have wished on anybody else or ever told anybody else they should go do. I said, combat is not an experience you wish on somebody else after you've been there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much all I tell them.
Okay.
If somebody asked me about some other things, I might, you know, give them political opinion, but that's, you know.
Right. What do you think about the books and movies that have come out on the Vietnam War?
I've read quite a few of them. I think in some ways the best book I ever read about Vietnam was a book, what's his name, Heinemann. It was a science fiction book called The Forever War.
Mm-hmm.
Heinlein? I think it's Heinemann.
Okay.
Joseph Heinemann, maybe.
Okay.
It's called The Forever War, and it's a science fiction book, and he was a grunt in Vietnam, and he wrote a really wonderful science fiction book, and it's really about going back over and over and over again, and good book in some respects. We Were Soldiers is a good read, I think. The movie was okay.
Mm-hmm.
I liked Sam Elliott as a sergeant major. He reminded me of my platoon sergeant. I thought that Mel Gibson was too good a shot. I mean, there were some things in it that I didn't particularly like. I thought Hamburger Hill, there were some scenes in Hamburger Hill I thought were really good. You know, I really thought there were some scenes in there that looked like combat in Vietnam, whereas most of the things I've seen, I haven't. So there's bits and pieces. You know, I kind of hated Apocalypse Now. It may be a great movie, but it's a great movie for somebody who wasn't there in some respects. I mean, but that was part of his vision. You know, he had a different vision about what he was trying to explain, and that part was okay. But if you're looking for realism, it wasn't. you know, it was a little strange. Then, in some ways, this is kind of funny, but in some ways, I think the best movie about Vietnam I ever saw, and it wasn't necessarily MASH, although that was pretty good, was Black Hawk Down. Mm-hmm. And just from the standpoint that I don't care where you were or what you do, I thought it looked like combat to me. I thought it was probably as close to that small unit combat action as I've ever seen in a movie, where the people are getting isolated and they're having to try to work their way back, and there was just some parts about it that I thought were, and even though it wasn't about Vietnam, that they had the feel of what combat in Vietnam was like in a way. Mm-hmm. There, even though it was a totally different situation and things. So, mm-hmm. I was trying to think. It's been a long time since I've read too many. I like the Tim O'Brien stuff. Mm-hmm. Certainly, going after Casiotto is a trip, but there's some truth in that, and the things we carried. Some of his stuff is very good.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a good writing style, which helps out.
What do you think about Vietnam today, and would you want to go back?
You know, I think about that. We think about that, and I talk to people who have gone back. We talk about if I went back, you know, the only thing I would care about is going back and walking over the ground I walked on, just going back to walk. I mean, I need it for me and not to go back and see how they are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, taking a bus tour through Saigon, I was never in Saigon. I was only in Da Nang for about 2 days before I went on R&R, and I didn't go out on the economy much there because by that time I'd been in the field 10 months, and I just didn't trust those people. I didn't want to go out there, and I didn't have a gun. So, when I went to R&R, they flew me into a big helicopter base that was, I caught a ride someplace, and I said, how do I get to Freedom Hill, to the R&R center? And they mm-hmm. said, oh, you just go out and hitch a ride. And I said, what? And I didn't have my rifle. They'd made me turn my rifle in. And so I went out and I said, no, that can't be right. And they said, yeah. So I went out and started walking down the street, and it took me a while, before I caught a ride. And I was the most nervous I think I was in my whole tour over there, because there's all these Vietnamese around every place and no Americans, and I'm walking down the street and I don't have a rifle, which felt strange, because that's the first time in 10 and a half months I hadn't had a rifle in my hand when I was walking someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a strange experience. And so going back to a Da Nang or to a Saigon or, it wouldn't mean anything to me. I'd like to go back to the rural areas and see how the people are there. I'd like to go out to Hoa Phan and just walk over the ground and just see what it's like. But I understand a lot of times they won't even let you go out into into where the old special forces camps were. I mean, it'd almost be like a religious pilgrimage in a mm-hmm. fashion, and then they tell me everything's changing, and so, who knows whether it would be a good experience or not. I went back to see where my grandparents lived when I was growing up, and my dad was in Korea, and
mm-hmm.
they moved the roads, and they tore down the places they lived, and I mean, I couldn't even find it, and that was more traumatic than if I'd left it alone,
Right.
So I don't know. I think about it every once in a while, and I've got a couple of guys that say that we ought to try to put a trip together. But
mm-hmm.
everybody I've talked to, I just want to go back, spend a few days in the area I was in, and come home. I mean, that's what
mm-hmm.
I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what do you think are or were the myths of the Vietnam soldier, the American soldier in Vietnam?
It was the what? I'm sorry.
The myths. And misperceptions.
I think one of the misperceptions is that, they were all 19 years old. I was 24, but I had several people in my platoon that were in, were 22, 23. A couple were older than I were and got drafted. And I don't know if, later on it was different or what, but, we had people that had been to college and, dropped out and got drafted or done different things. They're, I was probably one of the older people, but, you know, there was a lot of them were close to my age. So I think that's one myth, that they were all 19 years old. I suspect we had more of them that were 21, 22 than we had that were 19. And that was in my platoon. I don't know if that's a myth for the whole Army or not. The number of black troops in the field, I think, is a myth. There seems to be some myth that, you know, over half the Army was in the field, where we were putting all the blacks in the field, and we probably had maybe a quarter, maybe less, of the platoon was black. We had, you know, several Puerto Ricans, we had some Hawaiians, we had, you know, certainly a mix of people, but there it wasn't a predominantly black group. And I don't know if that's really a myth, or, you know, I don't know, but I've heard, you know, that over the years, they kept sending all the black people into the field, and that wasn't the case. I think the and after that, the myth that, you know, we were over there, we were all, you know, abusing people and doing things. And I think there are probably as much of that going on. I don't think there was as much as the perception was but there was probably more of it going on there than there have been in some other places. And I would think that, you know, they have a danger of that starting to happen in Iraq if we leave people there long enough. When you're in a totally alien environment and you're out operating and you're not safe, and you have guns and things, eventually I think bad things can happen to you mentally about the way you treat people around you. I think that, you know, the fact that everybody came home, there's all these druggies and people, I think that's a huge myth. Most of the people in my platoon, you know, came home and were productive citizens and went on with their lives. And we've had a couple that had problems, but, you know, for the majority, you know, one guy was, you know, head of a design team at Ford Motor Company. Another guy's a head of a nuclear power plant. You know, people that were just grunts. Came back, went to school, and did, you know, he got another one that owns an art studio. He's an artist and machine gunner down in Phoenix now. And another one of my machine gunners was an electrician and is a minister in a church. And, you know, so, I mean, I think there's a lot of myths about the Vietnam vet, and I think there's a lot of people out there that perpetuate that myth that may or may not have been in Vietnam, or they may have been some rear area person. I don't know what they're doing, but most of the grunts aren't going out there. You know, the field soldiers aren't going around there with their fatigues on and their hair long and stuff.
Right.
So I don't know. I guess that's my whole answer to that.
Okay. You mentioned that you had been to the wall in Washington, D.C. Can you tell me about your experiences there?
The first time I went there was probably when they opened it, November of 81 or 82, and it was the next summer. And I was there on business, and I took the afternoon off and took the subway over to the wall, and I got there, and it was overwhelming. I mean, when I think about it, it's still overwhelming. And I got there, and I just couldn't touch it. Could not touch the names. And
why not?
And there was I guess it's painful. It just is such a waste of humanity. War is it, and I just, you know, you just see people, and, you know, they're just snuffed out, and it's just a hard thing. And so a nun was nice enough to do some rubbings for me. And then as I've gone back since, and it's not, you know, it's still a powerful experience, but certainly not like the first time I was down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept looking, you know, it was real confusing. I think it's, at that time, there wasn't a good way to find somebody. And the Army or the, whoever it is, still has not done a good job, I think, of helping people find people that they knew, veterans,
mm-hmm.
Because they don't have their smaller units identified anyplace. There's no place you can go and find somebody who was an Alpha Company, 1st of the 20th Infantry.
Right.
They can tell you maybe if they're 11th Infantry Brigade or if they're a Maricao Division.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not know somebody's name, and you may not know exactly when they were killed, you
right.
know. And I think that makes it really difficult. So I remember the first time I got down there, it took me a long time to start finding the people that I served with.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people I was looking for that, you know, I didn't know that I knew that I were killed later on. It was really difficult to find the names, and there was no help. Now they've got little people down there with computer databases and little things, and it's much more helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I must have spent 2 or 3 hours down there just searching for names, and after a while it got, you sort of felt like a failure. You know, you were down there looking for these people and you couldn't find them, and it was
mm-hmm.
it was tough.
Mm-hmm.
It was very tough.
Well, John, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched upon?
No. I think that's a lot more than I expected to have come out. So you've been very, very good with this. And it's been fun thinking about some of those things, like, you know, the things that you just don't spend much time dwelling on about, you know, what did you have in your pockets?
Right.
I mean, that was kind of a fun exercise, and then you go back and you can actually almost sometimes feel it, because it was for so long you had the same thing in every pocket, and you know,
mm-hmm.
you can just visualize yourself reaching down in there, and after a while it starts coming back to you more and more about those little things, and
mm-hmm.
and the little things are kind of fun to remember.
Good.
So it's been a good experience, and I appreciate it.
Well, we thank you very, very much for your time and for doing this with us. And we'll go ahead and end the interview now with Mr. John McNown, Jr. Thank you, sir.
Okay.